I was kind of amazed to read what you wrote about Manhattan, because I didn't. You were so much more innocent in real life than
Beyond.
what you imagine, what one imagines you were from watching the movie. Because I always thought that you were sort of like Tracy, and that you were the
Yes.
sort of, precocious girl who could
I
date a
know.
42-year-old writer,
Oh, I
and be
know
totally
it.
cool with that. But in fact, you were like a virgin
I
and
was a
had never
virgin and
been to.
I'd never even really made out with anybody. I mean, Woody Allen, I knew that scene in the hansom cab going around New York. I knew that was coming for weeks. And I kept saying, like, how long is it going to be? Like, I was so scared. And I even asked my mother, how do I make out? And she was like, we don't talk about that. So I sat in front of a mirror, like kissing my arm, trying to see what I would look like. Meanwhile, the
This is
shot
just too much.
was just in a hansom cab from a very long distance. But I was so, it made me so nervous. At the end of it,
Sure.
I ran over to Gordy Willis, who was the
Yeah.
cinematographer who had made this amazing black and white movie, and
Yeah.
I said, I don't have to do that again, do I? I mean, he was like, everybody just laughed. They had no idea how I didn't know who this girl was. I was so not a sophisticated Dalton school-going girl. It just wasn't me. I mean, I love that Woody Allen made me feel like I was smart and intelligent and older, but I seriously had no clue.
No, but this is very interesting, because this is really about the ineffable magic of film. Because
It's amazing.
here you were, you have hardly any experience acting. You don't. It's not like you grew up watching films or that
Right,
much, or
no.
was really you'd never been to New York. You're playing this part, and you are so natural,
Right.
and you are so. It's the fact that that just happened like that and made this iconic role, and then you're nominated for Academy Award.
Oh, man. That is so great.
You don't smoke.
No, I don't smoke. I don't inhale because it gives you cancer. But I look so incredibly handsome with a cigarette that I can't not hold one. You know? You like the way I look?
Provocative.
I'm getting through to you, right?
Yeah. You have to excuse
me. She's gorgeous. She's 17. I'm 42 and she's 17. I'm older than her father. Can you believe that? I'm dating a girl wherein I can beat up her father. That's the first time that phenomenon ever occurred in my life.
He's drunk.
You're drunk, you should never drink.
Did I tell you that my ex-wife?
Who, Tina?
My second ex-wife is writing a book about our marriage and the breakup.
That's really tacky.
It's really depressing, She's gonna give all those details out, all my little idiosyncrasies and my quirks and mannerisms and not that I have anything to hide, because, but there are a few disgusting little moments that I regret.
Just gossip, Gossip is the new pornography.
You should never
the
let
daily
me drink.
Newspapers, I know. You should never let yourself drink.
You know, we ought to go, because I've got an exam.
Kids got to get up and. She's got homework. I'm dating a girl who does homework.
Well, I don't think 17 is too young. Besides that, she's a bright girl.
Oh, you get no argument from me. I think she's terrific. He could do a lot worse. He has done a lot worse.
Are you telling me that you had three affairs before me? That's really hard to believe. It's mind-boggling. When I was your age, I was still being tucked in by my grandparents.
Well, they were really immature boys. I mean, they were nothing like you.
No, what does that mean?
Well, I told you before, I think I'm in love with you.
Hey, don't get carried away, okay? This is a terrific thing. Move over, though. And it's a wonderful, we're having a great time and all that, but you're a kid, and I never want you to forget that. You're gonna meet a lot of terrific men in your life, and I want you to enjoy me, my wry sense of humor and astonishing sexual technique, but never forget that, got your whole life ahead of you.
Well, don't you have any feelings for me?
Well, how can you ask that question? Well, of course I've got nothing but feelings for you, but you know, you don't want to get hung up with one person at your age. It's charming, you know, and erotic, no question about that. As long as the cops don't burst in, I think we're going to break a couple of records. You know, but it's not a good thing. You should think of me sort of as a detour on the highway of life.
Excuse me, we were talking about orgasms.
Oh, no, please.
Really? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to.
Give me a break, because I'm from Philadelphia. We never talk about things like that in public.
Yeah, you said that the other day. I didn't know what the hell it meant then either.
I'm just about to direct a film of my own script, and the premise is this guy screws so great that when he brings a woman to orgasm, she's so fulfilled that she dies. Right now, this one finds this hostile.
Hostile? God, it's worse than hostile. It's aggressive homicidal. You have to forgive Dennis. He's Harvard director Beverly Hills. It's Theodore Reich with the touch of Charles Manson.
You look funny in that jacket.
I know. I had hope for something in the gabardine, but it's crazy, isn't it? So, do you miss me?
Yeah, do you miss me?
Of course I miss you. I love you. That's why I come and get you all the time.
Why can't we have frankfurters?
Because this is a Russian tea room. I mean, you want to have a blintz or something. Frankfurter gives you cancer anyhow. And besides, you see those two women here? They have very beautiful women that eat here. You know, we could do very well. I think we could have picked up these two if you were a little quicker. I'm serious. I think the brunette liked you.
So I have a chance to go to London and study with the Academy of Music and Dramatic Arts.
Really? When did this happen?
Well, the other day. Got a letter in the mail.
That's great. That's terrific.
Well, I don't want to go without you.
Hey, I can't go to London and study. I mean, you know, it's crazy, especially Shakespeare. You know, I don't look good in leotards or anything.
I'm serious.
Of course you should go. I mean, it's great. You'll have a great time in London. It's a great town, and you're a wonderful actress, and it's a terrific place to study. You know, you'll be the toast of the town. You'll have a good time, really. You shouldn't pass that.
So what happens to us?
Well, you know, we'll always have Paris. I'm kidding. What kind of question is that? You know, you can't think of that now.
You won't take me seriously just because I'm 17.
Yeah, exactly, because you're 17. I mean, look at it, man, it's ridiculous. When you're 17 now, when you're 36, I'll be...
63,
right, thank you. You know, it's absurd. You'll be at the height of your sexual powers. Of course, I will too, probably, but, you know, I'm a late starter.
Jesus, listen to this. Making love to this deeper, more masterful female made me realize what an empty experience, what a bizarre charade sex with my husband was.
Please, that is so nauseating.
Is this true? Did you make love with Jill and another woman?
Did she put that in there? Christ, I didn't want to be a bad sport.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, September 9, 2021. So I have been told. This is our sixth study session on Woody Allen's Apropos of Nothing. All I can say is we had folks who had suspicions or thought that it may be possible that this book wasn't really going to address Woody Allen and Su Yee's tragic arrangement and how that came together, the allegations. Wow. All I can say is wrong. That is going to dominate the rest of the book. We are basically at about the halfway point of the text. The remainder of the book will be dominated by Sun Yi, Mia Farrow, the allegations, all of that. He will be talking about all of that very explicitly beginning this week and riding all the way to the end of the book. So sometimes in reading, patience pays. I even had to say that to myself a few times, like, man, I thought we were going to get something juicy, and man, we didn't even get anything constructive, and wrong. Just had to be patient. And oh my goodness, Woo! I'm going to hurry and be quiet so we can just get to the text. One, we heard interview with Mariel Hemingway. She is the white woman, child at the time, who co-stars with Woody Allen in Manhattan, 1979, black and white film. All of these rave reviews, if you look on Internet Movie Database, it's rated a 7.9 out of 10. So that is, you know, very high on their scales, viewed as a classic. Mariel Hemingway was nominated for an Academy Award for her performance in this film at the age of 17. She may have been 16 actually when they were doing some of the filming for all of this, but you heard her interview at the beginning and where she talked about, hey, I was not some sophisticated teenager who was living in New York and going to the Dalton School. Pause right there. That should be familiar, going all the way back to Jeffrey Toobin. Dalton School, where have you heard that before? Oh, Jeffrey Epstein lied. I keep saying that, lying about their credentials. Why does that keep coming up? Lied about his credentials so that he could teach at the Dalton School. And then ultimately, Jeffrey Epstein, like Woody Allen, accused of having some sort of sexual deviance and attraction to young girls, even children. The late Jeffrey Epstein. Anyway, so she said, I was not at the Dalton School and all this. I was a virgin at the time, had not had any sexual experience, hadn't kissed a boy before. And she says at the end of that scene, where in the scene she's talking about in Manhattan, Woody Allen, you know, gives her this big kiss as they're riding around in the stagecoach in Central Park. Central Park 5. Talk about Central Park 5 and rapes in the park. And she says she runs off the set crying, like, oh my gosh, do I have to do that again? No wonder. A 17-year-old, again, she could have been 16 at the time of the filming. And it's not like some tender, loving kiss. She describes this, her words, this is from a more recent interview. She describes this as she also has spoken about how her first kiss, which was with Allen in the film, was an anxiety-ridden one. I had never kissed anybody, so the kiss in the cab around Central Park terrified me. I was worried about it for weeks, she told the New Cinema magazine in 2010. Fortunately, it was a long shot and I didn't have to do much. He attacked me like I was a linebacker. This is at Vanity Fair if you want to check out the entire report. But so you have all that for context. And then we just go, you know, as they say, directly to the horse. We heard a series of clips from the film Manhattan. So we start off. We hear the very opening scene of the movie where they have this montage where they have Gershwin, this respected white artist, and their classical music and all these shots of some of the best tourist sites and attractions in the New York City area. And then we see Woody Allen with his two white friends, one male, one female, that are in their 40s, and then his 17-year-old girlfriend, Tracy, where he's the one that's calling all this attention to Tracy. He starts off, he's smoking the cigarette because he thinks he looks so good at it. That's how vain, how egotistic, how narcissistic. I think we talked to some folks that talked about that before. We had where Woody Allen is not only writing the book, he's narrating the book, he's writing the screenplay for the film, he's directing the film, he's got to hop in and act in the film, have total control over the product. Just everything. And then I've got to hop in to comment on how great I look. And I'm just doing this because I look so great, smoking a cigarette. I mean, what in the world? What does it mean to be white? White culture. So we go from that to all this calling attention. She's 17. I'm older than her father and all this, blah, 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 blah. Then he slips in, oh, yeah, my ex, my second ex-wife, so no track record of success with females. And now I'm with a teenager, is writing this book about me. My second wife is now a lesbian. She's married to a woman, white woman. And they go from there and, you know, whatever. Incidentally, they mentioned that writing these type of books is pornographic. I thought that was important. Everything comes back to sexual. References are sexual, so many references to sexual filth often. 17-year-old comes back. Hey, I got to go. I got high school tomorrow. So Woody Allen comes in. Oh, and you even hear his friends talking like, she's 17, but I like her. I don't think that's a big deal. She's his best girl. Like, nobody has a problem with this at all. Then you hear Woody Allen talking to Tracy, 17-year-old. And he says, wow, you've had 3 affairs already? Now, I don't know if that means you've had 3 sexual encounters, 3 boyfriends. Have you had a so-called some sort of infidelity with a married person? Like, I have no idea in this context what affairs mean. Again, the interview, the real life, Mario Hemingway says, I'm not engaged in all this sexual activity. I'm 17 years old. What are you talking about? And it's, again, the same thing that we've talked about before where Woody Allen gets to project onto the females that they are supersonically promiscuous. He even accuses his ex-wife in the film of being promiscuous. And then he gets to be all coy and shy in this. He projected in the book before that it was Louise wanted to go outside and have sex in public. And he's like, what? We came to eat dinner. What are you talking about? And then he's talking with his son in the restaurant. He has his son who's about 10 years old. His son says, can't we get frankfurters? He's like, they'll give you cancer. You know, you should get a Blintz or something else. We're in the tea room. And they're beautiful women here. Like, oh my goodness, we could have picked up the brunette. You know, if you'd been a little bit quicker, I think she liked you. Now, again, his son is about 10 years old. Sexual inappropriate sex between an adult and a child. Consistent theme in this movie. And it seems to run frequently in his career. Next. I just said his ex-wife is going to write a book about him. So you heard that at the end. They're reading snippets from the book. They're like, oh my goodness, you had a threesome with your ex-wife? And it's the same pattern. He says, yeah, but she wanted to do it. And I didn't want to be a sore sport. I didn't want to be a poor sport. Same pattern. And it's in other, or I'll say it this way, others have testified that they also engaged in some sort of threesome with Woody Allen. Can read some of those reports later, but those are just some of the snippets. I could have played more that was in the same vein from the film. I didn't even include the segment where the 17-year-old Tracy is suggesting that they get involved in some so-called kinky sex. Let's try out some positions that you've never tried before, and it's the same thing. What are you talking about? Are you serious? Oh my goodness. You're a kid. With that, we will get started. I'm so glad I watched the film Manhattan. Wow, we're going to hear more about that this week. Context of white supremacy. What does it mean to be white? Audio segment 1, apropos of nothing. So strong.
When I regained my sanity, I made Zelig. I was interested in the documentary style for comedy since Take the Money, but now had more experience. With a cinematographer like Gordon Willis and my willingness to shoot in black and white, which immediately limited the box office, some countries would not show a black and white movie, and even now black and white becomes a hard TV sale, Zelig was about how we all want to be accepted, to fit in, to not offend, that we often present a different person to different people, knowing which person might best please. With someone who loves Moby Dick, for example, the protagonist will go along and find things to praise about it. With one who dislikes the book, the Zelig character will get with the program and dislike it. In the end, this obsession for conformity leads to fascism. I wrote the script, and waiting to begin pre-production, I wrote a Midsummer Night sex comedy. The latter was only meant to be a celebration of the country, of the woods with its alleged magic, and to have fun with the love and marital problems of some amusing people. I told United Artists I'd shoot them both at the same time. They liked the ideas, being gluttons for productivity, and I thought it would be easy, particularly if you're a comedy genius, which it turned out I wasn't, and it was not easy. But the problem was not physical. It was no trouble shooting a few scenes from a Midsummer Night sex comedy and then at the same or a nearby location switching costumes and doing a scene from Zelig. The problem was mental. it was very hard to get emotionally wound up in one world and to switch to another. I had trouble handling the switching of psychic energy, committed to do one tale, and suddenly having to retool for other characters and plot. I vowed never to try it again. A Midsummer Night's Sex Comedy did turn out very beautiful and magical, and nobody liked it or came to see it. Zelig had a much better fate, and the name Zelig has since entered the vocabulary, but is always used to designate a secondary property of the creation. It is frequently employed to denote someone who appears everywhere at popular events alongside the rich, the famous, a ubiquitous non-entity. But the primary meaning of Zelig should be when one searches for a word to describe one who keeps abandoning his position and adopting the new popular one. In both movies, I had a new leading lady, Mia Farrow. How did that happen? For that, I must go back to give some mildly interesting exposition. A few years earlier, I had received a fan letter from Mia, who I'd never met and only read about. I always found her very, very beautiful. Mia reminded me of Louise, a good beginning. Her letter praised my latest movie or my work in general, I forget which. But it ended with a sentence I do remember, and it was, quite simply, "I love you." It was a very nice letter to get from a famous woman and a beautiful one. I wrote a thank you, and that concluded the matter for a few years. I finally met her when I was dragged to a small party in Hollywood by Sue Mengers, whom I was pretty friendly with. I had known Sue when she lived in New York, and when she moved to L.A., she and her husband, Jean-Claude, hosted me graciously whenever I went out there. When we were all in Paris together, she took me for my first time to Maxime's and also on Christmas Eve to the Tour d'Argent, and I made that a little holiday ritual for years after with my friends. As a frequent dinner guest at her house in Beverly Hills, Sue was always trying to fix me up with one lovely movie actress or another, but for whatever reason, it never seemed to work out. She was great fun, and the stories about her are legend, though none will ever top her sizing up the crowd at a Hollywood party and referring to them as Schindler's B-list. On this night, it was a party that Mia happened to be at. We were introduced, made some polite small talk. The earth didn't move, and we went our separate ways. I met her once again years later. In passing at Elaine, she came in with Michael Caine, passed my table. We said hello. She got seated elsewhere, and I lunged back into my tortellini. Tortellini was one of the only things you could eat there, and that tasted passable if one's demands for flavor were kept at a minimum. I often told Elaine that her food would have been turned down by the lost party on the Donner Pass. Those were the few times Mia and I encountered one another. Now, the New Year's parties. I was never a big party-goer, mostly because I have my entering phobia. Once I'm in, I'm much better. Not great, but better. I really need someone with me dragging me in, a tiresome business for mature adults. But try as I have problems entering. So during Thanksgiving, my friends Gene Demanian and Joel Schumacher urged me to make a New Year's Eve party, and by hosting it, I would not have to enter. After much tergiversating, I agreed, especially since Joel said he would help. And help he did. He knew the best people for flowers, music, lighting, all the stuff that makes a great party. And a great party it was. I rented the Harkness House, the mansion once owned by Rebecca Harkness, that became a ballet school after her death. It was spacious and grand with a great hall of the type the King in Robin Hood movies eats a whole roast boar in, and where a picturesque reminder of the deceased former owner greeted you on the first floor. That is to say, there was an urn with Rebecca Harkness's ashes in it, designed by Salvador Dali, complete with fluttering mechanical butterflies. One floor we made into a disco, another a socializing space. There was caviar, an oyster bar, wherein I had to go find a dozen humans adept at shucking clams. There was wine and champagne, liquor, savories and sweetmeats of every sumptuous description. There were tons of flowers, and the men were elegant-looking, and the women decked out and coiffed, and All that was missing were the tumbrils waiting outside. Everyone was invited, and everyone came. Everyone in show business, in the arts, in politics, in sports, in journalism, in society. In one group, you might find the mayor talking with Walt Frazier, S.J. Perlman, Bob and Ray, and Tom Wicker. The group a few feet away could be Arthur Krim, Ted Sorensen, Bill Bradley, Liza Minnelli, Leo Castelli, Bob Fosse, Norman Mailer. It lasted all night, and about 3 a.m. breakfast was served in a huge basement, and many people went down and had ham and eggs and coffee and more wine. I got credit for a Gatsby-like evening, but all the credit should go to Joel Schumacher and my assistants who did the heavy lifting. Vowing never to get involved in such an undertaking again, I was talked into doing one years later and brought it off, perhaps not with the spontaneous brilliance of the first time, still it came close. Again, Toot New York showed up, and in among the giddy multitude was Mia with some friends, Sondheim, I believe, and Mia's pretty sister, Stephanie. Again, Mia and I exchanged pleasant hellos as she vanished into the crowd. I was at that time dating Jessica Harper, the sexy, bright, and talented girl from Stardust Memories. A few days after the party, I get a note, plus a book, a gift from Mia. She thanked me for the swell time and sent me a copy of The Medusa and the Snail. I sent back a note thanking her for the book and then made a casual suggestion that would eventually change the lives of many people. I said, if you're free one day, let's have lunch. Now, as I say, I was a bachelor, dating the female lead in my movie, who was quite terrific, and I liked her. But it was a casual thing. We were not in love or committed to each other. Jessica was adorable, but she liked snorkeling, and the thought I might eventually come face to face with a stingray kept me up nights. Not that I had any designs on Mia. I didn't know her. What if she was one of those actresses into nutrition or astrology? What if her religion included handling snakes or she didn't like the bicycle thief? All I knew was that she was a pleasant beauty who crossed my path a number of times over the years in the most casual way. We agreed to meet at Lutèce the following week as I was leaving for Paris shortly after. So I sat there and waited for her, and she showed up late looking like a zillion dollars. And after lunch and wine, we agreed to have dinner the night I came back from Paris. I grabbed the check, found her a cab, went home, and 2 days later, I was at Maxime's in the City of Light with Jean Dumanion. I had to be back in a week to do reshoots for Stardust Memories. After a fun week, I came back and took Mia to dinner. My secretary arranged the date. Woody will be back the 9th. Can he pick you up at 8? And that's the way I dated her for several months. I never phoned. My secretary always called and said, when are you shooting, but is 8:30 Thursday okay? And she'd say yes, and off we'd go, and she turned out to be bright, beautiful, she could act, could draw, had an ear for music, and she had 7 children. Tilt. I found it amusing in a sitcom sort of way that I was flipping into a relationship with a woman with 7 children, but at that point, it was nothing more than another fact about her. Should I have twigged at all over the idea that she had 3 biological kids and then adopted 4 more? Not really. It was unusual, but hardly sinister. Maybe for a more perceptive person, it would have signaled something slightly more than unusual, but with that face looking back at me over candlelight, one tended not to search for deal breakers. Besides, I like kids and always got along with them. I never had any pronounced feelings about having any of my own. If, when I married Harleen or Louise, either had said they never wanted children, that would have been fine with me. If either had said, I want 5 children, that also would have been fine. Kids weren't on my mind or agenda as a writer or filmmaker, but I was happy to be a father if my spouses so desired. I preferred girls, but enjoyed boys, as my son Moses will attest to. I taught him baseball, basketball, took him fishing. I think I'm a cliched father, addled in the eyes of my 2 currently college-age daughters, but loving and very dedicated to spoiling them. So Mia having 7 kids caused me no anxiety. We just met, and her goals in life were different from mine, and she articulated them intelligently and convincingly. The flirtation with my leading lady in Stardust Memories faded gracefully, and I found myself beginning an affair with a beautiful movie star who could not have been nicer, sweeter, more attentive to my needs. She was not demanding, better informed than me, more cultivated, appropriately libidinous, charming to my friends, and best of all, living directly across Central Park, so there was a major saving in car fare. In retrospect, should I have seen any red flags? I guess, but if you're dating this dream woman, even if you see a red flag, you kind of look in the other direction. And remember, I was not the most perceptive guy on the block, especially in matters involving Dan Cupid. In retrospect, the red flags existed every few feet, but nature provides us with a denial mechanism. Else we couldn't make it through the days, as Freud teaches us, as Nietzsche teaches us, as O'Neill teaches us, as T.S. Eliot teaches us. Unfortunately, I was never a good student. For instance, shortly after we began dating, Mia announced she had purchased a country house in Connecticut. She said she needed a place for the kids when summer vacation came round, which I found completely understandable. She said she knew I was a city boy, and if I had any problems with it, she'd sell it. I knew she adored the country, but as someone who had always been too with nature, I hated the country. I don't mind it so much in the daytime, although I'm not thrilled about dew on my shoes. But in the evening, when it gets dark and silent, I always expect to see a flayed hand come up from the lake or two red eyes at the window. Anyhow, I sensed our totally divergent tastes on how and where to live and spend time could eventually loom as a problem and chose to ignore it. A second red flag came up a surprisingly short while after we began dating, several weeks to be exact. Mia turned to me as we were seeing a movie, My Brilliant Career, and said, "I want to have your baby." Unused to requests any more aggressive than, "Are you going to eat that last piece of herring?" I was taken aback, but fielded it like a graceful shortstop. I recall changing the subject to lawnmowers and put it all down to over-dramatizing. After all, she was an actress and given to playing scenes. Not very long after that, and again, I'm talking weeks here, at a Chinese restaurant, she suddenly suggested we get married. The suggestion caught me in mid-egg roll, and I thought maybe she didn't have her contact lenses in and was mistaking me for someone else. When I realized she was serious, I told her that beside the fact we had only been dating a very short while, I saw marriage as an unnecessary ritual. I had been married twice, as she had, and I learned over the years if a relationship works, it works, but a binding piece of paper doesn't help to reinforce one's love nor rectify a situation that is soured. I was happy to be in the relationship with her, but nothing personal. I just wasn't thrilled with the idea of memorializing it. Then I think I lapsed into Nixon's checker speech and sang Old Man River from Showboat. Clearly, she was visibly annoyed hearing my cop-out. She withdrew the offer petulantly and made some remark about me spoiling things, by which I imagined she meant we met, dated, liked one another, and suddenly I was unwilling to progress. Her idea of progress was to run out and marry. But the swiftness of the proposal, such as it was, and her irritable reaction when I wasn't instantly up for it, should have clued me in that I was dealing with a more complicated person than just this fragile, beautiful supermom. The truth is, it did shake me up at the time, but it wasn't so traumatic that I felt I should quickly pack and go into the witness protection program. Should I have been flattered? I wasn't. We never married. We never even lived together. I never once in the 13 years we dated ever slept at her apartment in New York, apart from a small number of times that first year or two where she might stay a night in my place. We lived separately. The moment school ended, she lit out for Connecticut with her brood, and apart from a July 4th weekend or a Labor Day weekend, I spent the summers alone in Manhattan. What kept us together was a very convenient and pleasant arrangement, which I will soon describe, but I was enumerating the red flags that I missed or chose to miss right from the start. Here's another. Our backgrounds were solidly different. I had grown up in a lower middle-class Jewish family. My parents, cousins, aunts, and uncles all had their quirks and conflicts, but they were within reasonable parameters. No violence, divorce, no suicide, no drugs or alcohol, just whining and grousing about money and the doctor who did Ruthie's nose job didn't take off enough and maybe the guy who slices the sturgeon at Russ and Daughters should have done it. Mia's family was rife with extremely ominous behavior that swelled in the years I knew her. Drinking and major drug problems with siblings, criminal records, suicide, institution for mental trouble, eventually a brother convicted of child molestation and sent to prison. Every single pharaoh cursed with flaws that ran the gamut from the Athenian stage to the Lost Weekend, except, it seemed, for Mia. I was amazed how she could grow up tiptoeing through that minefield of craziness and come out charming, productive, likable, and unscathed. But she hadn't been unscathed, and I should have been more alert. In my defense, as we didn't live together, I had little knowledge of what really went on in her home. I knew nothing of the way she treated the children, the adopted ones in contrast to her biological ones. As Moses and Sunyi have described, she took great care to hide it from me, as she did from the world. Later, I will detail some of that for you, and you will be taken aback. Another red flag. An unnatural closeness with her son Fletcher. Too close. That one even I could see. And while it seemed very odd and a tad creepy, her family relations were none of my business. She was not someone I was planning to marry or even live with. So my take on this mother-son attachment was that it was her own affair. But it was clearly bizarre. I'd pull up in the car to pick her up for a date. She'd come strolling out of her apartment house, get into the Lincoln, and instantly grab the car phone and call Fletcher, whom she just left. Okay, the kid has trouble separating. No one has more empathy with separation anxiety than me. But as weeks pass, she begins bringing him along now and then on our dates. The kid is laid down to sleep under the table at Elaine's while all the adults eat, drink, and talk till midnight. I say, but won't he be too tired like this to function in school tomorrow? But if any reason he might not want to go to school, she didn't send him. He was the uniquely favored child, and he called the shots. A moment of conflict arose when I suggested she and I take a week and go to Paris. Only if we can bring Fletcher, was the reply. Otherwise, I'd rather not go. Of course, said more sweetly than I just said it. But won't the other kids resent the obvious favoritism, selecting only him to take to Paris? Don't worry about that. Can we bring him? No, I said. This was meant to be the two of us going for a week or a few days, a grown-up's only vacation. She wouldn't budge without the kid. P.S. We didn't go. I went to Paris with Jean Dumanion. We stayed at the Ritz, strolled the Champs-Élysées, a pair of flaneurs, knocking back our Romani Conti. I had just been introduced to wine, and I remember being a little drunk and viewing the Place de la Concorde lit up at night, and it was so beautiful, and I shook my fist at Paris like a character in Balzac and said wistfully, "You old whore." Unfortunately, I was facing a lady tourist from Detroit at the time, and she didn't appreciate it. There were rumors about Mia I discarded, because there were rumors. One was that she had behaved very badly with Dory Previn when Dory was married to Andre Previn. She insinuated her way into their household, became pregnant by Andre, and stole Andre away from Dory, causing Dory terrible mental suffering. Dory had written a famous song about how Mia had betrayed her called Beware of Young Girls, which I was unaware of. The truth is, I knew neither Dory nor Andre and was not about to jettison a new relationship over some rumor. It was only years later, when I was involved in a public custody fight with Mia, that Dory, whom I never met or spoken a word to, contacted me and told me the rumors were true and how deceitful Mia had been, and I must be aware of her. She alerted me also to a song she'd written, the lyric of which referred to some encounter that went on between a little girl and her father in the attic. The song is Daddy in the Attic, and the lyrics went, "And he'll play his clarinet when I despair with my daddy in the attic." She told me Mia would sing it, and she was certain that's what gave Mia the idea to locate the fake molestation accusation she would make in the attic. But I'm not quite up to that yet. Another rumor that I heard early on was that Mia's brother had been sexually aggressive with the beautiful Farrow sisters growing up. The Farrow brother, who is now serving years in prison for child molestation, has said that their father had molested him and quite possibly his siblings. Moses says that Mia had told him that she had been the victim of attempted molestation within her own family. Mia's father had a reputation as an unfaithful husband. Mia herself told me she caught him in the act with a famous movie actress. Mia had three beautiful sisters and three brothers. One brother died behind the controls of a plane. Another brother committed suicide with a gun. The third brother was convicted of molesting boys and sentenced to prison. Now, I know what you're thinking. What kind of boob am I? Given the profile I just rattled off, why didn't I bail, fake my own death, and start over in a situation with less potential for emotional combustion? I have no answer. I just know that a charming personality and big blue eyes have always been able to launch a thousand ships. So here was I, blinded by a bright actress with a drop-dead punim, putting my little four-chambered organ in her hands and telling myself that it was amazing how Mia escaped all the family bedlam. Whatever effort it took to control herself, to hide things, to function, to charm, she managed with great acting skills. Her children were well-mannered and polite. Never a peep out of them. I got along with all of them, although I did find Soon Yi a tad sullen. I took a particular liking to Moses, a small Korean kid with black-rimmed glasses. I only learned much later by reading Moses' account of growing up in that household and Soon Yi's tales that Mia disciplined them all psychologically and corporally into submissive obedience. For example, Moses writes, "I witnessed siblings, some blind or physically disabled, dragged down a flight of stairs to be thrown into a bedroom or a closet, then having the door locked from the outside. She even shut my brother Thaddeus, paraplegic from polio, in an outdoor shed overnight as punishment for a minor transgression." Mia has, of course, denied it, but Judy Hollister and Sandy Bollock, two women who worked in the house at the time, both corroborate the story exactly. Moses' essay is devastating, and I advise you to read his blog for yourself. Moses back then was Misha, but one day at a basketball game watching the great Moses Malone play, Mia fell in love with the name Moses and changed her son's name. I was fine with the change because I loved the name Moses and didn't care for Misha. Mia always liked to change names. She changed Dylan's to Eliza, then to Malone. Then she tried changing Soon Yi's name to Gigi, but Soon Yi wouldn't go for it. Ronan was Satchel, then Harmon, then Seamus, then Roman. I, on the other hand, always gravitated to naming kids after my African-American heroes. When Ronan was born, I named him Satchel, after Satchel Paige. I named the two girls I adopted with Soon Yi Bechet, after the great jazz virtuoso Sidney Bechet, and Manzi, after his drummer, Manzi Johnson. I've taken some criticism over the years that I didn't use African-Americans in my movies, and while affirmative action can be a fine solution in many instances, it does not work when it comes to casting. I always cast the person who fits the part most believably in my mind's eye. When it comes to the politics of race, I have always been a typical liberal and sometimes maybe even radical. I marched in Washington with Martin Luther King, donated heavily to the ACLU when they needed extra to push the Voting Rights Act, named my children after my African-American heroes, and said publicly in the 1960s, that I was in favor of African Americans achieving their goals by any means necessary. Anyhow, when it comes to casting, I do not go by politics, but by what feels dramatically correct to me. Back to my personal life. For a while, the arrangement between Mia and me seemed convenient for both of us. We weren't in love, but we provided one another with reasonable companionship. Winters, we dined out often, saw movies, worked together on films. Summers, she would take the children to the country, and I'd be a summer bachelor, remaining in Manhattan. I visited on July 4th, gritted my teeth for the weekend amidst the mosquitoes and humidity and bees and ants. The kids all played in bathing suits. They swam and rolled around in the grass and tramped through the woodsy foliage. I was always dressed in long slacks and long-sleeve shirts with my ever-present hat, and not one of the kids ever got a tick, but I got Lyme disease. In addition to July 4th, I visited for one other day on Labor Day. So I saw Mia and the Farrell clan about 3 or 4 days every summer for some years. When they returned to the city, we'd start going out again, but by then, she spent fewer and fewer nights at my apartment, and since I never stayed at hers, the relationship didn't exactly deteriorate, but mellowed into a relaxed dating one. It was still occasionally intimate, but less so, and going no place special. Over the next years, we made a number of films. Then somewhere in among them, Mia explained to me she wanted to have more kids. It was unfathomable to me, since she had more than enough. But she explained in that sincere, highly intelligent way she has that I enjoy making movies and she likes raising kids. When I pointed out that it seemed impossible to be able to devote sufficient time to raising so many children properly, she said I was wrong and knew nothing about raising children, since I only knew what I had seen my mother and aunt do. I, though skeptical, agreed she must know better than me. She had once flown to Texas with Sunyi to adopt a Mexican infant, but sent him back after a few days in her New York apartment for reasons known only to her. I also recall her adopting a little spina bifida boy who lived in the apartment for several weeks, but her son Fletcher found him annoying, so he was sent back. If there were other kids she adopted and returned, I have no idea. As I said, I lived on the other side of the park. It was about that time that she told me, rather than adopt another child, she'd really like to be pregnant again. I looked over my shoulder to see who she was talking to, but she meant me. I didn't want to father a child, not under the circumstances that existed. I spent no time with any of her kids, except for Moses. Not that I didn't like them, although ironically, Sunyi couldn't stand me. Mia assured me I could participate in rearing a new child to any extent I cared to. If I wanted to be a hands-on father, great. If not, she'd raise it. And I would be the same free soul I'd always been. I'm almost too old as it is, she'd say plaintively. You know how I feel about motherhood. And you are under no obligation. After all, what's one added face living at my apartment when you come over? She was right, except she was wrong. What followed was months of trying to impregnate her, a phenomenon we could not seem to make happen, despite trying everything short of me donning feathers and doing a fertility dance. As time passed, we continued to work together and make a half dozen films, which I'll touch briefly on later. Finally, throwing in the towel, she gave up and adopted a young baby girl she named Dylan. I was totally indifferent to the whole enterprise, caught up in movie making. Still, I figured if it made Mia happy, fine. But that's not quite how it worked out. I quickly found this tiny baby girl and found myself more and more holding her, playing with her, and completely falling in love with her, delighted to be her father. After a year or two, I fussed over her, and Mia said, "Boy, you are really ready for fatherhood." I was still playing chess with Moses and plenty of sports. He had asked me to be his father, and I thought he was a great kid and agreed. I didn't legally adopt him at that point, but as he'll tell you, I was his father in every substantial way. And now there was an added treasure. I found myself bolting out of cabs, stuck in traffic so I could race to Mia's home and get there before Mia put Dylan to bed. As she grew, I took her to preschool and picked her up, as the school was closer to where I lived than where Mia lived. It was a new, pleasurable dimension in my life, a sweet kid I could hug and tell stories to and try perhaps in vain to teach Cole Porter songs. I was a very loving father, without being a legal father, but it never occurred to me I needed a piece of paper. Mia seemed okay with my enthusiasm. She even wrote when I finally did adopt Dylan what a wonderful father I was to her and how much Dylan adored me. And then one day, Mia announced she was pregnant. I naturally assumed it was by me, and the wolfbane had finally kicked in. And despite her suggesting Satchel was Frank Sinatra's child, I think he's mine, though I'll never really know. She may have still been sleeping with Frank, as she hinted, and may have had any number of outside affairs for all I know. As I said, we lived apart. The news did not throw me, as I was enjoying Dylan so much, and the thought of another child was actually exciting. I wrote a script for Mia with a pregnant character so she could act it as she began showing. I called it Another Woman and had the great pleasure of working with Jenna Rollins and, too briefly, Gene Hackman. It was my first film using Sven Nykvist, Ingmar Bergman's cameraman. Sven was a big, likable talent who had had an affair with Mia in the past, and we all worked well together. Mia's acting was excellent, and it would be even better in my least seen film, September, where my good friend Joel Schumacher said, I saw it and thought, why would you want to make that picture? Well, I wanted to because some years back I had seen Uncle Vanya made into a movie in Russian and thought it was such a beautiful piece of work by Andrei Konchalovsky. I wanted to do something like it. The problem is that one never figures on a confounding intangible, so although I did all the things Chekhov might have done, I left out an essential, unquantifiable ingredient. Genius. Chekhov automatically infused his work with genius, something that you can't learn or control. And so even if someone like me does all the right things as a dramatist, the sauce does not thicken. Still, as my kick is in the making of a film, it was great fun to play it being a Russian dramatist. Mia was wonderful in both those films, and I always felt she never got her due acting. Many years back, Pauline Kael had called me and said, you know who you should work with? Mia Farrow. I had nothing Mia was right for at the time, but it seemed like a reasonable thought. Eventually, it came to pass, as the author of the King James Version might put it. My relationship with Mia, as I said, had mellowed into a pleasant one, less passionate, but still carnal on those occasions when the planets formed a syzygy. And then suddenly it took a rather ominous turn. Here's my theory, and mind you, it's only my take on matters. See what you think. Very early on, as I had described, Mia turned to me when we were in the movies and said, I want to have your child. Now, it was years later, and she had finally struck pay dirt, impregnated as she was by yours truly. From the moment this natal mega ball was hit, she turned off me like Diane Keaton once did to oysters in New Orleans. Keaton, who previously adored oysters, was standing in a bar with me and happily expunging an order of Gulf Coast bivalves when suddenly she realized what she was about to put in her mouth. Dropping it back on its bed of crushed ice, she never ate another in her life. And in such unabridged fashion, Mia turned to me and said that she would not be sleeping at my house ever again, and I should not get too close to the upcoming baby, as she had questions about our relationship continuing. The key she had given me to her apartment years ago, she now wanted back. Though I grasped that over the past years our relationship had become more serviceable than all-consuming, still, this came as a sudden shock, particularly because since Dylan's appearance on the scene, I had come over to Mia's apartment more frequently to visit Dylan and often used the key. I even came up to the country to visit more often after Dylan was born. I would have preferred to stay put in town, as the life bucolic affected me like chloroform, and I could never get used to the sound of a moth hitting the bug zapper. It was like Lepke getting the chair. The truth was, I made the drive to the country almost every weekend to play with Dylan and Moses, whom I had strong feelings for. I tried rekindling my boyhood love for rod and reel to help scotch the ennui up there, but I couldn't swing it. Still, I did teach Moses to fish and managed to fly cast, happy I hadn't lost the old knack of placing my royal coachman somewhere up in the trees. Cement baby that I was, I screwed things up at Frog Hollow, because when Mia bought the place, her good-sized pond was brimming with frogs who ate mosquitoes and kept the place mosquito-free. I, thinking I was doing her a favor, stocked the pond with bass. Who knew the bats would eat the frogs and there was no one left to eat the mosquitoes? But all of that was before Mia's pregnancy. Now she wanted the key to her apartment back, and when I did come up on weekends, she had become cooler and indifferent. My theory, which I've long-windedly come around to, is that I served my purpose, knocking her up, and had become irrelevant. I had once written a sketch where Louise and I play spiders. She is a black widow, and I impregnate her, and as in nature, she then kills and eats me. Gee, I thought, reacting to Mia's behavior. You don't think. When I made the trip to Connecticut to visit Mia, who used to greet me, now rarely stopped whatever activity she was involved in to say hello. The relationship, always civil, continued to ebb away in ever larger chunks, and in the city as well. The routine devolved into the following. I rise about 5:30 a.m. and walk across Central Park to her house by 6:30. I would have breakfast with Dylan and Moses and return home, dropping Dylan at school. I was Dylan's responsible parent, as was testified to in court by a teacher at Brealey. She swore I was the only parent who ever came to the parent-teacher conferences while Mia didn't seem interested enough to show up. The teacher explained that only I attended all discussions of Dylan's marks and periodic reports on how she was doing. I would take Dylan to school, go home, and work. I would not see Mia all day unless we were filming, which was only about 8 weeks a year. The rest of the time, I'd write at my penthouse and then go over to Mia's apartment about 6 to sit with Dylan and Moses when they had dinner. I'd stay for another little while, maybe some chess with Moses or make up tales to amuse Dylan. Then I'd say goodnight to Mia, who usually had retired early to her room, and I'd go meet my friends, and we'd go to Elaine's for dinner. Every so often, Mia and I might go out to dinner, but it had become increasingly rare. When Satchel was born, things took an even darker quantum leap. From his birth, Mia expropriated Satchel. She took him into her bedroom, her bed, and insisted on breastfeeding him. She kept telling me she intended to do it for years, and that anthropological studies have shown positive results from tribes where breastfeeding goes on much longer than on the Upper West Side. Years later, two very professional and perceptive women who worked in Mia's house, Sandy Bollock and Judy Hollister, the first as babysitter and the second as housekeeper, described numerous incidents. Sandy reports seeing Mia sometimes sleeping in the nude with Satchel, now Ronan, a number of times till he was 11 years old. I don't know what the anthropologists would say about that, but I can imagine what the guys in the pool room would say. Of course, it was a little late for red flags by then, but here's not a red flag, but a skull and crossbones that was hoisted loud and clear, and I was either too thick or too preoccupied with second-act problems to notice. Mia did not put my name on Satchel's birth certificate when he was born. Why would she leave it off? Why exclude me after all that heartfelt nonsense about wanting to have my child? Was he really not mine? Clearly, I was being escorted out of the picture long before our dramatic breakup. Mia has tried to get around this scam by saying, as we were not married, the hospital required that I sign a separate form. But she is not being truthful when she says she presented one to me, which I gave to my lawyer and never returned. Clearly, that makes no sense. I would have been happy to sign on as Satchel's father. I was looking forward to his birth, was in the delivery room holding Mia's hand when he popped out, named him Satchel, and would push later to be the legal father of Dylan and Moses. But Mia never told me it was required, nor gave me any form to fill out. If she wanted me to be his father and gave me a form, she would have said, "Hey, where's the form I gave you?" Anyhow, Mia was delirious with Satchel. She monopolized his time, and short of me forcing the issue, which could have led to some sort of custody proceeding where my position was quite vulnerable, he was rarely available. I say vulnerable because I had no legal claim to Dylan and Moses, and I could easily lose them if I pressed too hard for access to Satchel. I had my hands full trying to work around Mia's unnaturally obsessed behavior with our new son, which was worse than her lunacy with Fletcher. Fletcher by now was showing some academic problems, the result, no doubt, of his mother's willingness to let him go to school or stay home as he wished. As Satchel would get older and display high intelligence, he would eventually usurp Fletcher's position as the favorite. Mia had little parenting time left to spend on Moses and Dylan or any of the other kids. But then they were adopted kids, and both Moses and Sun Yi described the second-class citizenship of the adopted children. Fletcher and Matthew were both biological, and she adored them. Sasha, Matthew's twin, she favored least of the biological children and could speak derisively about him often. Once, when he overheard her from the next room, he wept. As Sun Yi pointed out, Mia enjoyed adopting, loved the excitement, like one buys a new toy. She liked the saintly reputation, the admiring publicity, but she didn't like raising the kids and didn't really look after them. I felt peculiar when it was designated to me to go before the press to try to downplay the embarrassment when some of her kids were busted for stealing. It is no wonder that two adopted children would be suicides. A third would contemplate it, and one lovely daughter who struggled with being HIV positive into her 30s was left by Mia to die alone of AIDS in a hospital on Christmas morning. I was, as my shrink pointed out, mainly a sponsor in the household. I had employed Mia for 10 movies, hired her sister, hired her brother, hired her mother, given her a tax-free gift of $1 million so she could better support all these poor kids, not just mine. Finally, I decided in a moment of clarity that not being the legal father of Dylan and Moses was just not acceptable. For years, I had assumed full responsibility for both of them as their father. They were by now my children, too, and if I was ever to voice my disapproval with the weird raising of Satchel, which I knew would cause Mia to erupt, I needed the legal clout of paternity for the other two. Interestingly, for someone who always wanted me to father her child, Mia was suddenly very cool to the idea of me adopting Dylan and Moses when I broached it. At that point, I was completely unaware that I had been left off Satchel's birth certificate. But Dylan and Moses loved me. Typically, one early morning, I went to Mia's apartment, scooped up Dylan and Moses, while Mia was forever alone with Satchel in the bedroom, door shut, other kids left to their own devices. I took Dylan and Moses to my cutting room, where I edit movies. They could play while the editors and I cut. They loved the attention we all gave them and playing with all the movie equipment and ordering food. Sometimes I would take Moses and Dylan to my apartment, and we'd play games, and I'd do some magic tricks for them. As time passed, I tried my best to include Satchel in my parenting, but he was always harder to see. I saw him mostly evenings when I'd come over after work. Satchel was always very cute and smart, and Moses was as cute as they come. And until then, I always found little girls cuter than little boys, probably because I was a little boy, and grew up among little boys and knew that little boys grew up to be those creeps who used terms like, in my view, or at this particular point in time, or telling you, you have a nice portfolio. The boys I knew got into fights, started fires, played hooky, and got bad marks, while all the girls at PS 99 were clean and sweet and never gave a middle finger to any teacher, and they all had such neat penmanship. Between being raised in a family of affectionate women with a close relationship to my older cousin and a good one with my younger sister, it's no wonder I felt particularly comfortable directing women over the years. So many of the people I work with are women, my producers, editors, doctors, lawyers, assistants, but I've always had great affection for Moses and Satchel, even though I was forewarned not to get too close to Satchel. And so I pushed Mia with the idea of me legally adopting Moses and Dylan. She was very wary and it took her a long time to agree, but then one day she agreed. Don't know what prompted the change. Maybe she did the math in her head and saw some advantage in me becoming financially responsible for both of them. Maybe she wanted to keep things going on a low flame for work reasons. Or possibly she wasn't as possessive regarding those two kids since they were not biological. Sometimes I think if you asked Mia then, she might very well have said she loved me. But if so, it was delusional. If she loved me, she had a funny way of showing it. No intimacy, Not much dining together, no traveling, no more house key, no interest if I visited in the summer. In fact, a bit of an annoyance. Civil, but not warm. Planning her future, whether I fit in or not. I can go on. If Dylan and Moses hadn't existed before Satchel was born, I never would have gone over to her apartment anymore. There would have been no reason to. The air was out of our relationship. Our lives had grown apart. We were social companions on those occasions where there'd be a dinner or an event. But after the event, she'd go home, and I'd go home. At one point, before Satchel was born, I wondered if maybe moving in together might work, since I visited twice daily to see Dylan and Moses. But neither of us really had much enthusiasm for that idea, and it faded fast. I guess I thought living with Dylan and Moses would be fun. Maybe even Mia and I'd grow closer. I had learned nothing from my fiasco with Louise, and the reality was neither of us really wanted to live together. After a few weeks of speculation and even going through the motions of checking out some huge apartments, we both mercifully let the idea drop. With the birth of Satchel, she made it clear what a foolish fantasy the possibility of any deep relationship with her would have been. Anyhow, for reasons only God would know, she agreed finally to the adoption, and I became the legal dad for Dylan and Moses.
Context of white supremacy. First audio segment, Woody Allen's Apropos of Nothing. Again, for folks who were concerned that we were not going to get to the tragic arrangement, this will dominate the remainder of the book. The number to dial, 720-716-7300. The code, 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. The number again, 720-716-7300. The code, 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. The email, untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. Let's do some of the folks who wrote in first, then we'll get to the phone lines. Very excited for this week's reading. First up, one of our investors writes, greetings, Gus. Number one, tergiversating. Tergiversating. Definition, to make conflicting or evasive statements. This should be the title of this chapter. Yikes. What an indictment. And he put a new word in there too. Tergiversating. Tergiversating. Sorry. Tergiversating. Number two, in comparing his parents and family to Mia Farrow, he suggested that his family background was much more well-adjusted. Didn't he describe his father as a scam artist, bookmaker, who fired guns at a random group of people in the subway out of some unsubstantiated fee? Yes, yes, he did. I remember, like, didn't, I was saying the same things, like, didn't he compare or talk about his parents as being like gangbangers and they hung out with all kinds of hoodlums and stolen material? Like, wait a minute now. Hypocrisy, I've been saying that word a lot. Number three, he describes getting drunk on wine in Paris. Didn't he say he doesn't drink alcohol earlier? I think he did say he was never into to drugs and all that. He's just a square. Hypocrisy. Number four, the entire section on his reasons for not having any African Americans in his movies was a classic rationalization justifying his practicing racism. I'm not racist. I named my children after African-American athletes and jazz performers. I believe in affirmative action, a fine solution in many instances, but just not in my case. I was with Martin Luther King Jr. at the March on Washington, etc. He should have added, and I rode the bus with Rosa Parks. Woody Allen has been making movies since 1965, approximately 60 years by my count, most of which he had complete artistic control over, and he does not have one film that I remember. I have seen a lot of them. Gus T has not. In which an African American has any type of meaningful role. All he needed to do was end his paragraph with, "And we shall overcome someday." Make me vomit, me too. Number 5, Alan's description of his relationship between him and Mia Farrow is one of the most bizarre things I have read in a while. "We are not married, but have this quasi-parent relationship with some of her children, and I don't see them half the time because we live separately. Farrow and I have a sexual relationship, but not that often, but she wants me to impregnate her, and I comply, but we are not in love, but maybe the kid is not mine. She is a horrible mother, but I didn't know it at the time. Woe is me. I'm just some unsophisticated, saintly rube taken advantage of by this psychopath. If this was written to improve public opinion regarding him, I think he failed miserably in my view." Well, no mincing of words here. I do not know. I'm going to have to look to see what is the perception. Like, how does this make Woody Allen, you know, sound in 2021 for a book that was published just last year, you know, recent? How does this make him sound? Does this seem logical? Does this seem reasonable? Let's check in with some of the other listeners, see what folks who dialed in. Patience. Sometimes one has to be a little bit patient for things to kick in. Let's see. *61 if folks have thoughts, observations, comments. Folks are spectating a tad. Before I get to my notes, buddy, Woody Allen, since he mentioned Satchel Paige, right? Named his child Satchel. I think he had quoted Satchel Paige a few weeks before, and I just thought, like, I don't, how many people do you know that go around quoting Satchel Paige in any era, even older people? Anywho, Woody Allen is shown, they'll have him on camera at the New York Knicks basketball games. And this has been the case for years, decades and decades of this, even after the whole controversy with Sun Yi. And I've said in the book, he's naming his children after black male jazz artists. Even in the film Manhattan, he has a scene where he's on the couch and he's thinking, what are things that make life worth living? The second thing that he names is Willie Mays, black male baseball player. Later, way down the list, he says, oh yeah, Tracy, 7-year-old girl that he's dating. But one of the first things that he names, Willie Mays. So Woody Allen wrote this piece called Notes of a Know-Nothing Knicks Fan. He wrote this piece in 1998. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I think it is fascinating. I'm just going to read some of the pieces, bits that stood out to me, just because I've been saying that there seems to be a lot of fetishizing of black males, black male jazz musicians, black male basketball players throughout the book. This article, wow, reinforced everything I thought. So, Notes of a Know-Nothing Knicks Fan. "Now, a favorite crackpot notion of mine is the following. I think the Knicks never regained their past championship form because they sinned by trading Walt Frazier to Cleveland." He was mentioned at the party that Woody Allen threw. "I can't prove this, but those who have read the Rime of the Ancient Mariner know what the shooting of the bird did. Not that Frazier was an albatross, quite the contrary, he was, in my opinion, the greatest of all Knickerbocker players, and he was, for a time, not only the soul of the team, but one of the spirits of the city. I recall him, after a routine night of superb basketball, tooling around in his chauffeured Rolls, dressed, to put it mildly, like an extrovert, and lighting up the various night spots of Manhattan like he had just lit up the garden. Clyde came up with the Knicks and was a major, I think the major, cog in the peerless machine that took two championships. It should have entitled him to tenure in New York forever. Dealing him to the Cavaliers upset some balance in the cosmic order, and the fruit of this curse could be felt from the days of Spencer Haywood through Bob McAdoo, Michael Ray Richardson, Lonnie Shelton, the Bulls, the Rockets, Rick Pitino, Hume Brown, Mike Fratello, last year's brawl in Miami, many heartbreaking last baskets by Reggie Miller, by Michael Jordan, even by Sam Cassell. Pause right here. The Sam Cassell reference that he's talking about, all of these, he's mentioning failures and tremendous historic losses the Knicks had in the playoffs to lots of players. This Sam Cassell one. 1994, the Knicks lose to the Houston Rockets in the finals. Sam Cassell was his rookie season, ACC school. He has a big game three in New York, hits a big three, is rolling around on the floor. Iconic moment. I don't mention all this detail for any reason other than this is the second time Sam Cassell and the 1994 NBA Finals has come up in the Cavs Book Club this calendar year. The other time we had to talk about this finals specifically, game three, Sam Cassell is rolling around on the floor, hits the big three. I think he was a 4-point play even. He got fouled on it for them to win the game, his rookie season. Game five gets taken off the air and interrupted because Orenthal James Simpson and the Bronco Chase. In fact, the documentary film that they have about the championship season for the Houston Rockets, game five interrupted. What were you doing? Sam Cassell, Kenny Smith, all the players get to talk about that. I'm sure even Woody Allen, if he was at that game, remembers like, wow, O.J. Simpson. Continuing, this leads me to ponder the question of Allen Houston, also a terrific shooter. If the Knicks are to be a force in the coming years, his deadly shooting eye will be a major reason. So why is it more fun to watch Tim Hardaway score than Houston? Are Houston's picture-perfect jump shots and lunging drives any less an achievement? But why was it always more fun to watch Isaiah Thomas drop 30 than the great old pro Joe Dumars? Is it because Thomas and Hardaway project danger and Dumars and Houston reliability? I suppose star quality is unmeasurable and what makes one dancer merely great and allows another to be Fred Astaire can only be felt and never understood. In Ewing's absence, it became clear also about the role of John Starks, who is another veteran of special impact. When Starks first joined the Knicks, he was an out-of-control, sullen, and pugnacious player, always spoiling for a fight. Over the years, he was forced to pay his dues. For a while, he was yanked from the starting five. He was seated at times during the final crucial minutes of big games and criticized for taking wild shots, for missing baskets and foul shots, and worse, firing up blanks in the closing minutes of playoffs. Starks bore the humiliations with grace and remained loyal and dedicated to the team, wanting only to contribute positively. He has ripened into the heart and soul of the Knicks. Moving him to the sixth man position has been an inspiration, as he is a player who makes the most of dramatic entrances. He has become a leader who never quits and a galvanizing force who turns on the team and the fans. And finally, what can one say about Charles Oakley? Or can one say enough? Oakley has been a consistently tremendous ball player for New York who contributes mightily night after night, season after season, and actually gets better with age. Of course, I'd hate to wake up in the middle of the night and find him hovering over my bed with that look on his face, but on the court, he's worth every cent they pay him. And what about Marv Albert? I'd like to see him back doing the New York broadcast. I miss that voice, full of city street urgency. He made the games exciting to listen to, and to deny him his place as the voice of the Knicks is unworthy of those who are empowered to hire. Incidentally, lest the reader not think I'm totally blasphemous in my tastes and feeling, I should point out that I experienced a true religious epiphany watching the All-Star Game this year, 1998, when the torch was passed from Michael to Kobe Bryant. For a minute, I thought I saw angels at Madison Square Garden. My feeling about Kobe is that he is a knockout talent and they should encourage him to play a complete game with assists, rebounds, and defense and not use him to come in and make circus shots. But the concept of passing a torch, I did find a hoot no matter how many times the television announcers used the phrase. It's a concept alien to basketball, which is a team sport, and Michael Jordan has not created a holy order like the papacy, where there is a line of accession. I'll stop there. The reason I read all of this is not because of basketball affinity, exactly what I said at the top, fetishizing of black males, all the way through. Now, the first part, he starts off with Walt Clyde Frazier and talking about how dapper he dressed and they were cursed for kicking him off the New York Knicks. And then we just heard him mention today he's partying with Clyde Frazier. Something I just find about that, having this white guy, I'm sitting here and spending all this time admiring all these black players and what they're wearing, what they have on. Why not even get Clyde Frazier into one of your movies? You're doing all this New York love, and so many of his movies are set in New York and about New York. Why don't you get Clyde Frazier in a movie? You love him. He continues now when he talks about who is more exciting to see score, Allen Houston, Joe Dumars, Isaiah Thomas. I have never heard of a basketball player described as dangerous. He says that there's an element of danger, or that Hardaway and Thomas project danger. That's even an interesting way of writing it. I've never heard that. What's dangerous about dribbling a basketball or shooting a basketball into a hoop? What's dangerous about that? Danger to whom? I'd be curious if Isaiah Thomas, Tim Hardaway, who later, well, yeah, that's another story way down the road, but have you all ever been described as dangerous for the way that you play basketball or projecting danger? He comes next down and he says, he's talking about John Starks and his tenure with the New York Knicks, battles against the Bulls and everything, and he says, Starks was a galvanizing force who turns on the team and the fans. I just highlighted that because in writing, that phrase or metaphor, turn on, often has a sexual connotation. I am sexually aroused by something you're doing. You are really turning me on. People heard that phrase before? I'm just saying, same applies. And many people have said that about white people out spectating at these events, watching these sweaty black males running around. Seems like there could be a sexual component to it. In fact, that's exactly what Dr. Gerald Horn said when he was with us, that his basketball coach, white basketball coach, was doing this, take advantage of the black male players on the team. And then Charles Oakley, my goodness. Now, Charles Oakley, that's another one. Lots of ways to deviate here, but black male Charles Oakley, where he says, of course, I'd hate to wake up in the middle of the night and find him hovering over my bed. I don't tend to think of any black athlete or any athlete, period. I don't tend to think of, wow, what would I do if Tom Brady was hump? Like, what? What? And it even reminds me, you know how they'll talk about, there's a lot of articles about this fear that white women had about, oh, I'm going to be raped by a black male. And even this is becomes a desire and a source of excitement. That almost sounds like the same type of thing. Woody Allen cowering in the bed and waking up. Oh, Charles Barkley is there, big black man. Don't, you know, that type of a thing. And then he has the whole Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant thing and all this nonsense. The late Kobe Bryant. But to me, just all to have him here for this is decade. This is about 30 years of him watching black ball players, and this has continued over the last 20 years. I'm sure he's, you know, sat around and watched LeBron James and Carmelo Anthony and Julius Randle, now all the rest of it. I'm sure of that. Even the language that he's using, metaphors and such, seems like the same. They're dangerous and sexual. That's consistent throughout the system of white supremacy, especially for black males. dangerously sexual. You all can let me know if I'm talking crazy. Let's see, before I get to some of my notes, caller 0526, did you have commentary? 0526?
Greetings, guys. Greetings, callers and listeners. Mia Farrow's family, her family history, I think that that's a lot of insight on what it means to be white and the whole sexual violence that occurred in her family. I have a white associate, and she was also molested, raped by a by her uncle. It's not her brother, like what happened to Mia Farrow's family, but it is a relative, and that is ancestral, and that is a behavioral pattern of white people, I have noticed. And Woody Allen said a lot of interesting things this segment. He said Mia Farrow's eyes were so powerful, blue eyes, and that some sort of metaphor involving ships. And I'm like, wow, that's very interesting, because white people, white men, they definitely, you know, have been waging this war of white supremacy against non-white people for their white woman. You know, this is what they do it for, and the white woman definitely helped them into practicing and maintaining this war of white supremacy. Another thing I thought was interesting that he made, when he was talking about the fertility issue, which is also what it means to be a white wealthy woman, because white people are always having fertility problems, possibly due to their genetic inadequacies. And but he made a joke about how a rain dance joke, which is when they're mentioning their problems, they have to throw in a little anti black or not anti non-white joke in there. And he also mentioned another one. He said the wolf bane had a word because she managed to have a child, and wolf bane is actually a toxic plant, which would not be helpful in helping a person to have a baby, I'm guessing. And he put a lot of these different spins, unique spins on how to practice racism and white supremacy, because the whole naming his offspring after black people, while also not having black people in his film, is very, very, just really incorrect. And I think he didn't have black people in his film because he's like, he's just like a anxiety, paranoid filled individual, that him being around black people and him having to, like, you know, work with black people in that capacity probably wouldn't have been constructive for his being, I suspect, maybe later on. But yeah, his usage of the words is very interesting. He said a darker quantum leap instead of saying like a dark turn. Really racist. And Mia Farrow is just a really refined, racist, powerful white woman. He described her her process of getting children, like buying new toys, like getting new toys, literal pets. Non-white people are literal pets to white people. They go out and adopt us like they're getting new dogs. And I think that's all I have. My cellmate would like to chime in as well.
I recently watched a documentary about Mia Farrow, and I learned that she the children that she would adopt, she would actually give them new names whenever she felt like it. So I think she was at one point trying to call Sumi, like, Jade, and she would call all of her non-white children whatever name she felt like. So it really does sound like it's just a pet or an item in her home. And I don't know if it was talked about before, but actually I think two of her children have died, have committed, suicide. Oh, okay. But yeah, I just think the whole idea of Mia Farrow collecting so many children, it seems very, very incorrect, with non-white children. And I imagine that the dynamic between Woody Allen and those children being very unhealthy. Thank you.
And I think that's why the poll mentions white people should not adopt children, because they should not adopt non-white children, because oftentimes they're very hazardous and dangerous for the child, who, like, using the example, an example from Mia Farrow's offspring. She adopted. They can easily be killed and are just left in a more incorrect state than they would have been with their own attempted family. And and my last thing is this name Satchel. I don't know who named a child Satchel, which is literally like an accessory bag type thing, but really bizarre individuals we're learning about here through this text. And I'm thinking along this time in.
Much obliged for the insight. We talked about the dangers of transracial adoption for some years on the program. Let's see here. I'll kind of go through my notes and then I can piggyback on some of the comments that we heard from folks who wrote in and folks who just dialed in. *61 if you have other thoughts. Let's see. So the portion that we read this week, I'm kind of going back to the beginning of my notes. I feel like it's more of the name dropping and even the parties and what have you that they're having, like, oh, we rented the Harkness house and this big mansion and all this, like more just the bragging of this opulent lifestyle that a white person can have. Next, he talks about all the food that they had, and they had caviar. I thought Welsing moment right there as well. Black eggs, fertility. Folks who are, the point that was just made, white genetic annihilation, that's a part of white culture, to struggle with producing children biologically, and then you consume black caviar and black coffee and white cigarettes. Let's see. As I just said, he name drops Walt Clyde Frazier and all these other folks, mostly white. Bill Bradley, who eventually became governor of New York and ran for president. Norman Mailer, again, these are our titans in the Hollywood entertainment industry. Joel Schumacher made Falling Down and a number of other interesting films as well. In fact, Joel Schumacher, if you look at his body of work in terms of projects that he's known for, he did Falling Down, which is important. Dr. Welsing actually talked about that film, White Genetic Annihilation, there. He also did 8mm, and he did the film, it was one more, A Time to Kill. He directed A Time with Samuel L. Jackson. Remember that one? Oh, my goodness. But a theme in at least a few of those, children being raped. That's how A Time to Kill starts off. 10-year-old girl gets raped by those racists in Mississippi. And then 8mm with Nicolas Cage, same thing, that this child rape is a big syndicate where powerful white people are able to do this and make kind of snuff films about this and get away. That's Joel Schumacher, who's hanging out. He was, I guess, the person who helped Woody Allen set this whole thing up. He said who deserved credit for all of this. Next, let's see. The pattern that I've seen consistently with Woody Allen in this book, in his films, is projecting. I'm the victim. I'm just some stupid, dumb white guy. I'm not paying attention. And it's these women, man. They are promiscuous and supersonically promiscuous and vile and crazy. And just everybody is out to get old Woody and old dumb Woody. I'm just not bright enough. I'm just not alert enough to be able to pick out that these folks are crazy. Like, that theme is consistent in his works, films, all of it. Where he says he didn't really think anything about her having seven children. I mean, any time period in life, you could be talking 1700s, 1900s, 2000s. I think anybody would like, whoa, you have how many children? That would be something to consider. Not just, oh, how amusing, she's got all these children. La-di-da-da-da-da. And moving on. I just don't know too many people that would be, especially they're adopted. I'm a white man. You've got all these adopted non-white children too. Like, maybe I'm in error. Next, he says, I preferred girls. I think last week I talked about how many times the word girls is in this book. And even just he's saying it in this context, he preferred girls in terms of children. But Woody Allen doesn't really strike me as a parental figure. He doesn't strike me as someone who, oh, yes, I'm just itching to be a father. For boys, for a boy or a girl. Let's see. Let's see. In retrospect, I should have seen any red flag. Oh, that's another one where he talks about he missed the red flags because Mia Farrow is just so beautiful, and she's got these big blue eyes and all of that. Again, that's a part of racism, white supremacy, and the white beauty aesthetic, the beauty con game that Pam talked about. And again, I don't believe you're just going to be so mystified that she's so beautiful that you miss all of these adopted non-white children running around. Like, what? And then he even goes into more, and in my view, this is more of the look how smart I am, all of the white cultural references about how smart I am. I'm such an intellectual guy. He says nature provides us with a denial mechanism, else we couldn't make it through the days. As Freud, Dr. Welsing, talked about the nonsense of his theories, all that sexual stuff, sex with your mom and all the rest of it, teaches us, as Nietzsche teaches us, the Ubermensch, Superman, as O'Neill teaches us, as T.S. Eliot teaches us. Unfortunately, I was never a good student. Again, it's all of that. If you're not a good student, you wouldn't even know these people's names or even a scintilla of what they wrote and talked about to say, oh yeah, denial is a part of the human experience needed to get through. It's at the same time to lie to you. Oh, I'm just a dumb white guy. I'm just a dumb white guy. I'm just a dumb white guy. And at the same time, I'm flexing about how smart and intelligent and well-read I am and aware of white culture I am to do all this name dropping. He continues, as someone who had always been too with nature, I hated the country. I think the phrasing that people are accustomed to hearing is one with nature, meaning connecting. He's not connecting. He said that several times in the book. I don't connect with nature. I don't like being outside. I like the city, being in New York, where I can hit and run, smash everybody's car, and drive off. I love it. Yes, New York. Take me to the Knicks game so I can ogle some black males. Go outside in nature. Let's see. Let's see. He talks about the marriage proposal. Even the languaging. I thought this was important. He says, the moment school ended, she, Mia Farrow, lit out for Connecticut with her brood. Brood is a collection of young animals, generally. I just thought that was important since these are not his biological children and she's got these adopted non-white children. For a white person to be using that, man not, woman not, child not, just lots of different ways where non-white people are represented as something other than humans. Let's see. The hypocrisy is staggering, where he says, my parents, cousins, aunts, and uncles all had their quirks and conflicts, but they were within reasonable parameters. No violence, divorce, no suicide, no drugs or alcohol. What you just said, as the person who wrote in, investor said, like you bragged about your dad shooting off his gun in the subway and knowing all these gangsters and criminals and fencing stolen material. He bragged about all that. See, that's the sort of thing, like, are you even remembering what you wrote at the beginning? Are we supposed to have forgot all of that? Are we supposed to compartmentalize all of that as something else? So then we can just bash Mia Farrow's family. And I'm not even saying what he's saying here is inaccurate. We had people who wrote in before saying Mia Farrow's no saint and those non-white children that she abducted committed suicide and she didn't care about them. I am not saying that any of that is false. No caping for Mia Farrow here. I'm not in support of white people adopting any non-white children, Woody Allen or Mia Farrow. Even why would you be attracted to someone who's doing all of that, Woody Allen, Woody? But the hypocrisy, yeah, her family was crazy and criminal, and I should have known from jump. I was just a dumb white guy not paying attention. I got caught up in her blue eyes. Like, get out of here, Woody Allen. That right there, see, when you're lying, it's no need to say that. It's no need to just bash her family. My family wasn't like that. I didn't have any experience like that. When you've already contradicted that in the book, his editor even should have caught that, like, hey, Woody, I don't think everybody that reads your book is going to forget what you said at the beginning. Let's change this up a little bit. Next. Mia's family was rife with extremely ominous behavior that swelled in the years I knew her. Drinking and major drug problems with siblings, criminal records, suicide, institution for mental troubles. Eventually, a brother convicted. Oh, they cut off the footnote. Eventually, a brother convicted of child molestation and sent to prison. Again, what does it mean to be white? and white culture. For a lot of non-white people, just having all of this in your family would preclude you from being a big star in anybody's films, Woody Allen or anyone else. Not Mia Farrow, apparently, who continued to have a huge career in spite of all of this. Incidentally, Woody Allen in his 80s, married to someone where he's functioning like a stepfather to this non-white person who is 36 years younger than him, 35 years younger, and him having the audacity to describe somebody else as very odd and a tad creepy. Are you flipping serious? Let's see. Next. Yeah, all of this. See, he just goes over the top with, I'm just dumb. I was just a dumb, non-observant white guy. He says, now, I know what you're thinking. What kind of boob am I, given the profile I just rattled off? Why didn't I bail, fake my own death, and start over in a situation with less potential for emotional combustion? I have no answer. I just know that a charming personality and big blue eyes have always been able to launch a thousand ships. Now, Gus T has said no one galvanizes violence like white women, Emmett Till or any other era. But this here, way too much Woody Allen. Woody. I was blinded by a bright actress with a drop-dead punam, meaning face, putting my little four-chambered organ in her hands, heart, and telling myself that it was amazing how Mia escaped all the family bedlam. Whatever effort it took to control herself, to hide things, to function, charm, she managed with great acting skills. He drops down. This is a divergence from the audio. This is not what he said in the audio reading. In the book, it reads, I took a particular liking to Moses, a small part Korean kid with black rimmed glasses. In the book, he says, a small Korean kid. There's no such thing as part white, part Korean, all the rest of it. Just, I thought that was important that in the book it's part Korean. He doesn't read that. He just reads Korean. I don't know if this means that perhaps Moses had a white parent, non-white parent. I'm not sure. Let's see. This taking names from black people, I do not find that constructive. I don't find anything to brag about. I don't find it as evidence that you're not racist. Like, and they're specific black people. Like, he's not going and getting, like, black Martin Luther King Jr., people of the time period, right? He's not getting Jomo Kenyatta, Minister Malcolm. I mean, it's Malcolm as opposed to Moses. No. It's ball players. Satchel Paige, Moses Malone. I'm not, you know, downplaying black musicians. I'm not disparaging entertainers. I'm just saying that that's a trope in the system of white supremacy, that one of the few ways we'll allow black people to maybe get a few nickels and not just be abused and terrorized as flagrantly, we'll let you entertain us, sing a song, do a dance, play some sports where you can get brain damage, that type of a thing. We'll allow you to do that sometimes. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. Jack Johnson, Muhammad Ali. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. But I mean, that's such a limited amount in terms of what you will allow a black person to. We might allow you to do this job, maybe. And then get some recognition for it as being pretty good. Let's see. He calls them his African-American heroes. That another insert vomit button. Like, are you serious? These are not your heroes. These are people that you fetishize. Victims that you fetishize. This whole line, he was at the March on Washington, insert vomit button. Like, that would be the equivalent of, I adopted a non-white child. I have non-white friends. I went to school with a non-white person. I voted for President Obama. I voted against President Trump, that type of thing. Tacky as they come. Again, Woody Allen could have made a film about the Knicks, man. Easily. I mean, how do you live in New York all these years and worship New York, all of the black people, all the non-white people that live in New York? There's no way your films can just be consistently praise and worship of white people in one of the, what they call, more diverse cities in the country. This is not Iowa. This is not Utah. You walk by black people every day in New York, even in Manhattan. Let's see. Anything else? I just, when he gets to all this about Mia Farrow, keeping his name off of Satchel's birth certificate. This is a powerful white man. At this point, he's won Academy Awards. You traveled all over the world. You've been to the White House repeatedly. You know powerful politicians, other powerful white people all over the world. You've met the Queen. Are you telling me that you, Woody Allen, can't get a lawyer and go in and get your name on the birth certificate? In fact, if you're that involved and you were there and you literally caught Satchel at the delivery, how in the world are you not there talking to the doctor? Oh, yeah, I'm the dad. Boom, boom, boom. All this information. I mean, come on, Woody. You got to tell me something better than all this. Let's see. White genetic annihilation, their struggles with fertility. I don't know if this is Woody Allen is not fertile because he's not a spring chicken at this point, or if this is Mia Farrow, either or. But white people struggling with fertility, white genetic annihilation. Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. Woody Allen goes fishing. He says he would go up to Connecticut and visit a little bit, and he goes to do some fishing with Moses and some of the other children, and somehow he got his royal coachman somewhere up in the trees. A royal coachman is a type of fishing rod in this context. I just don't find Woody Allen to be coordinated enough to think he was involved in too many sports at all. I don't believe he was involved in baseball very much, even when he was younger. They show him dribbling a basketball in Manhattan, and he looks so uncoordinated. I find it is impossible for me to believe that he played basketball at any point. They show him playing racquetball in the film. It's the same thing. His hand-eye coordination is so terrible, and I'm not like a star athlete. I've never been at any point in my life, but I mean, I've played racquetball. I've played basketball. I know what it looks like to see someone who at least can dribble a basketball with some coordination. That's not Woody Allen. And Manhattan is 1979, so I mean, he was about 40 years younger. He would be in his 40s, so he would not have been geriatric or what have you. Most folks in their early 40s that I know of still have quite a bit of coordination. They can still go out and shoot some hoops or do whatever. Let's see. Let's see. Anything else I want to make sure I get in? All the information about the suicides of these other children, as I said, of these other adopted non-white children that Mia Farrow had. We had folks who had written in. Some of them, it seemed, were caping for Woody Allen. And just Mia Farrow is no count. And look what she did. She abused the other children and she made all this up. Again, I am not advocating for Mia Farrow. She would be a suspected, I'm just saying that not to name call, for stealing, abducting all of these children. As some of the callers pointed out, changing their name every other day. This has been long running for whites in Hollywood, right? Charlize Theron, the current edition of Mia Farrow, going Brad Pitt, I think, and his former wife going out and stealing all these little non-white children in different parts of the world. I mean, white people, they do a lot of the same things if they're effective in maintaining white supremacy racism. So I do not absolve her at all. It would be they are both guilty. And if anything, why would Woody Allen be attracted to someone like that to begin with? Not just the blue eyes. Let's see. And then he says this, being raised in a family of affectionate women with a close relationship to my older cousin and a good one with my younger sister, it's no wonder I felt particularly comfortable directing women over the years. So many of the people I work with are women, my producers, editors, doctors, lawyers, and assistants. I think that has a very much 2020 Me Too. Hey, I love females. I get along with females. I love them. I always have. I'm not some scourge, some lecher. I'm out here going after these young girls. And that very much has a defensive feel. And for me, the way he has just what I've read, what I've seen in Manhattan, I do not believe this at all. He could have had the folks working for him. That could be true. And I don't know about his relationship with family, but that does not translate into, oh, I have some gargantuan respect for females. Again, there's way too much projection onto the females, even Tracy, even Mia Farrow, that the problem is with them or that they are instigating all of this sexual conduct. Even I think that's going to happen again with Soon Yi, where it's projecting, where she's the one who's instigating this. And I'm what? Me? I'm just a dumb old white guy. What? What are you talking about? I could be in error, but, you know, that's my assessment, at least where we are at this point. I will pause here. Make sure. Yeah, I got all my notes for this time. I'll pause here. Make sure we didn't miss any hands. I don't see any hands or what have you. So if you have additional comments to share as we get to the second audio segment, just make a note. We should have ample time to share. This is Woody Allen's Apropos of Nothing. There will be lots more on Sun Yi and Mia Farrow and all of this for the remainder of the book. Let's see. We'll pause here. Get ready for audio segment number two. Context of White Supremacy, Woody Allen, Apropos of Nothing. Let's see.
And now, before I get back to my movies, let me fill you in on how Sun Yi and I went from two people who never particularly liked one another to a couple now married over 22 years and still passionately in love. Sun Yi never knew her father in Korea, and her mother either couldn't afford to or didn't want to take care of her. She remembers herself as dirt poor. Rural life is a nightmare for Sun Yi as a tiny child, and she ran away from home at age 5 and wandered the streets of Seoul, like the urchins in Buñuel's Los Olvidados. She ate out of dumpsters and once was starving so badly she picked up a bar of soap from a trash can and tried to eat it. She was taken off the streets by nuns and wound up in an orphanage. She spoke well of the orphanage to me. The nuns were kind to the kids. Then one day Mia showed up and adopted her. This was years before I knew Mia, but Sun Yi remembers it well. Sun Yi had no say in the matter. One would think of this as great good fortune, but Sun Yi, then 7, did not. She took an instant disliking to Mia, who showed up, plucked her from a life and friends she had gotten used to and liked, and showed no warmth or empathy. Mia then took her out of an environment she had bonded with and on a tour of other orphanages where Mia browsed for new orphans like one goes through the remainder bins in a bookstore. Failing to find a human she fancied, Mia moved on. She took Sun Yi to her hotel room and plunged her into a bathtub and left her there alone. Sun Yi had never been in a bathtub before, spoke no English, and didn't know what was going on. Mia was strict and impatient with a fierce temper. Over time, she tried to teach Sun Yi English, not the easiest thing for an orphan to pick up overnight at 7. Mia would awaken Sun Yi in the middle of the night to drill her and yell at her for not learning fast enough. Sun Yi had trouble with English, and Mia would grow angry and frustrated. Later, she would punish Sun Yi's inability to learn to spell faster by holding her upside down, dangling her, and threatening to put her into an insane asylum if she didn't learn quicker. At that point, Mia and her husband Andre were not getting along, and they had screaming fights that would wake Sun Yi and terrify her. Mia regarded Sun Yi as hopelessly stupid. I recall when she spoke to me contemptuously of her soon after we met, saying Fletcher at 4 had a better brain than Sun Yi at 9. Not really knowing any of the kids at all, and assuming Mia was a super mom as the press made her out to be, I listened in distracted agreement. But as I would later learn, Sun Yi was not just the diamond in the rough, but round cut and flawless. Nor was Mia a super mom or even a fit mom, and she never bothered to get to know her adopted daughter. Mia never attempted to develop her. They started off living in London for the first 2 years in a lovely house. Sun Yi took me to see it years later, and it was truly lovely, in a town about an hour out of London. Mia never had any interest in Sun Yi, and she alone among the children had the temerity to challenge Mia's cruel authority. Despite the proximity to London, Mia never once took Sun Yi to a show or a museum. This indifference in raising her continued in New York, where they moved eventually and lived for years. On no single occasion in Manhattan did her mother ever take her to a movie, a show, a museum, or even for a walk in Central Park. She got no basic education, as Mia moved the kids around to suit her filming schedule. They got read to a bit, but not much else. After London, Egypt, Bora Bora, Colorado, Los Angeles, Martha's Vineyard, all with no steady education. They settled on the Upper West Side, and Sun Yi and her siblings were placed in some lightweight play school and then abruptly plunged into Ethical Culture, a high-end, competitive, and demanding school. Predictably, all the kids there had to be transferred because none could handle it. But Mia and Sunyi were always at odds. Like the other adopted girls, Sunyi was made to do chores, really her mother's responsibility. When my sister visited Mia's apartment because of the interaction, she thought Lark, another adopted daughter, was a servant and was surprised to hear she was family. Mia was indifferent to the real needs of the adopted kids. Moses relates this harrowing tale. Most media sources claimed my sister Tam died of heart failure at the age of 21. Tam struggled with depression for much of her life, a situation exacerbated by my mother refusing to get her help, insisting that Tam was just moody. One afternoon in 2000, after one fight with Mia, which ended with my mother leaving the house, Tam committed suicide by overdosing on pills. My mother would tell others that the drug overdoses were accidental. Years later in high school, when Sunyi broke her ankle playing soccer, Mia didn't even bother to take her to the doctor, but only told her to go by herself and not to get x-rays as they cost too much. A high school girl in great pain from a broken ankle, Sunyi made her way to the doctor's office by herself on a bus and was frightened to allow the doctor to x-ray her ankle. Finally, the disbelieving doctor phoned her mother and insisted. She got the x-ray, but going against Mia's orders meant punishment, often being hit. Sunyi saw this happening all around her. Mia didn't care enough to take Moses to the doctor or emergency rooms, and so Lark or Sunyi had to do it. Sunyi had to take her brother and little sisters to school on various buses every day at a very young age. She had to do all of Moses' therapy massages on his palsied leg nightly. Mia was proud to advertise herself as a mom willing to adopt a child with cerebral palsy, but the dedication and work involved fell to the other kids. When Sunyi went to look at colleges, Mia had no interest, didn't go with her, and let her go alone. Finally, her friend's mother was so appalled by the neglect, she went with Sunyi to look at the schools. Mia never even bothered to attend her adopted son Thaddeus' graduation. According to Moses, and corroborated by both the housekeeper Judy and the babysitter Sandy, she made Thaddeus wear heavy iron leg braces for public appearances rather than his lighter plastic ones because the lighter ones were worn under the trousers and would not be seen by the press photographers, and Mia wanted it publicized that she adopted the disabled. The iron braces were visible to the camera as they were worn outside the trousers. Thaddeus was the one she locked in the outdoor shed overnight. Is it surprising he committed suicide with a gun 10 minutes from his mother's house? Mia acted surprised that Thaddeus was suicide, but the truth is he had attempted suicide 6 or 7 years earlier by overdosing on medicines and had to be rushed to the hospital to have his stomach pumped. I offer this background because when Sunyi went off with me, it was not simply a case of some ungrateful orphan betraying a kind and loving benefactress who had changed her life from rags to riches. And Sunyi's personality is large. She is not a shrinking violet. She had to have some moxie to hit the streets and fend for herself at 5. Could you? I couldn't. I was still being sung to sleep at 5. Sunyi was the one adopted child who stood up to Mia and incurred her wrath. Consequently, she was hit. Hit with a hairbrush. Hit with a phone. And once Mia hurled a ceramic rabbit at her, barely missing her head, the tchotchke shattered into a million pieces in the room. The kids told me they loved it when I took Mia out to dinner, so they were rid of her, free for a breather. A number of times, Sunyi's sister secretly came to me and asked if there was any way I could spring them from having to go to the country on the weekend, as it meant chores for Locke. Cooking, cleaning, it meant babysitting work and boredom for Sunyi, who wanted to be with her friends like any other teenager. Sunyi and I had no interest in knowing about each other. I thought she was a quiet, boring kid, and she thought I was her mom's patsy. All that was missing was a ring through my nose. When we discussed it years later, I explained in my defense that whenever I came over to the apartment, or visited the country house, I saw no signs of turmoil or tyranny. Soon he said it was a totally different ball game when I was not around, and that I was foolish to think Mia ever loved me, as she always had great romantic interest in her friend and neighbor, Mike Nichols. She was crushed and depressed when he remarried rather quickly after his divorce from Annabelle, his wife. Soon he had me down for an unperceptive Ignatz who served me as a high-profile significant other and kept her career moving. At any rate, for years, I never gave Soon Yi a moment's thought. I was too busy working. I acted in a film directed by Paul Mazursky called Scenes from a Mall. I heard it was a god-awful movie. I did it for two reasons. The first was the money, but the more important second reason was because I had great respect for and wanted to work with Paul Mazursky. I found him to be great fun to be around, a terrific storyteller, fine director, and nice man. I got to work with Bette Midler, whom I liked. We shared the same birthday, along with Richard Pryor. It means nothing, unless you're a horoscope loon. Bette was fun and nice, and she had a tiny little daughter who grew up to be a fine actress. I used Sophie in Irrational Man, and even lengthened her role because I thought she had a real acting talent. Mazursky had just come off an Oscar-winning project, but with me and Bette, for whatever reason, the movie rocketed directly into the bathroom plumbing. And I didn't think we acted badly, but who knows, I never saw it. And after that, I was busy directing Shadows and Fog, a film I knew was destined for commercial doom. But you can't let those things scare you. You'll keep doing safe, middle-of-the-road projects. My movie was set in Germany in around the 20s or 30s, and Carlo De Palma shot it in black and white. Santo Loquasto built the biggest set ever made at the Kaufman Astoria Studios in Queens, and the whole picture, the exteriors and interiors, were all shot indoors. That's how the Germans often did it in the Ufa days, and I wanted that look. It was an existential murder story, and you should have seen the faces of the Orion suits at the first screening when the lights came up. They expected a conventional serial killer story, but a comic one. Instead, they got my personal take on life and death, employing a grim but hopefully amusing metaphor. To say the movie tanked at the box office would be describing it through rose-colored glasses. It's not a bad idea, but you have to be in the mood for it, and marketing tests showed it did not appeal to Homo sapiens. After that, I shot one of the best films I ever made, in my opinion. I decided when I finished writing Husbands and Wives that I'd shoot the movie predominantly handheld and obey no rules of filmmaking. I'd cut when I felt like it, not worrying about people facing the right direction. I'd jump cut and go for the opposite of pretty or well-made. It came out to be a good film, I thought, and I'm not easy on my work. It was somewhere on the project, either the writing, the pre-production, or the shooting, that things started to warm up between Soon Yi and me. Earlier, I had taken her to a basketball game, as I had season tickets. Once or twice, I remarked to Mia how reclusive Soon Yi seemed, and maybe she needed a shrink. Mia said, "Why don't you go for a walk with her or take her to a basketball game? You're always looking for someone to go with." It was true. I owned four season tickets to Madison Square Garden, and sometimes had no one around who shared my interest. I finally asked Soon Yi if she liked basketball. She liked it well enough to say yes, probably figuring it was free popcorn. And so I did take her to a game. And awkward as it was, I confronted her about the fact that we never got along and said it seemed that she didn't like me. She assured me that it wasn't so much that she didn't like me, but thought I was a feather brain, her mother's lollipop, sleepwalking through an embarrassing hustle obvious as the Turk con. Clearly, she had no trouble volunteering her candid opinion of me, and I resisted the temptation to pierce her superior judgment with my rapier wit. She felt her mother had treated me like a veritable cat's paw, and I was a consummate sap for not getting it. I soon learned she and Mia didn't get along, and life at their home was quite different when I was not present. I began to realize this was not an empty young woman as Mia had painted her, but quite an intelligent, feeling, perceptive one. It was the start of a friendship that would slowly grow over time and climax with the preposterous realization that we cared a great deal about each other. It took a long, long time to move from square one to this mutual caring, but it would happen and surprise us both. Still, Despite an unexpected nice time at that first basketball game, I was too busy to even think about anything but movies. In spite of her mother calling people and insisting Soon-Yi was retarded, she graduated from college, got her master's at Columbia, worked, and raised a family. But that all comes later. Meanwhile, Mira and I were still droning along, thanks to that reliable, all-purpose, waterproof adhesive, inertia. As much as I nosed around trying to see if I could pick up on the darker side of Mia's behavior, apart from her obsession with Satchel, I never saw her beating anybody or throwing any fits. It was okay for me, as I liked seeing my kids, however limited, and working, playing jazz, my little jazz band, which Soon-Yi likens to Ralph Cramden's Raccoon Lodge, was great fun. If I had met any interesting women, I was very ripe for the plucking. And there came a time down the line when Soon-Yi, in town from college, was going to accompany me to a basketball game again. I looked forward to seeing her, catching up, exchanging intimate confessions and laughs. As we chatted at the game, I found I was enjoying her company more than I should have. I asked her about her mother saving her, and wasn't an apartment on Central Park West and a country home and a private school a much better deal than an orphanage? No, she said. She preferred the nuns. By now, the Knicks were losing, and my attention was needed on the court to jinx the other team. I took her home, dropped her off in front of her apartment building, and sped off into the night, thinking that I'd had a really nice evening for the first time in a while. And she was an amazing young woman who had been through a lot. Most of what she said about her mother caused me to twig on the early red flags which billowed feverishly in the turbulent winds of retrospect, if you'll excuse my bid for a National Book Award. All I know is I took her to another basketball game, and despite that famous photo in which it looks like we're holding hands, I never took her hand. First, I didn't have that kind of relationship with her at that point. And if I had, I never in a million years would have done anything in public, much less in the brightly lit, packed arena of Madison Square Garden. My death wish did not extend that far. We chatted and had another very nice time. As we had gotten on the subject of movies, I asked her if she knew the movies of Ingmar Bergman, always searching for that perfect woman into Swedish films. She did not, and as I waxed euphoric over his work, it was decided I would set up a screening of The Seventh Seal for her at my screening room. This was me being romantic, The Seventh Seal. I have a screening room where I edit my movies. The editor and I edit the movie, then go into the other room and screen it, hate it, return to the editing machine, and re-edit it. Now, who can say I'm not a fun guy? A young, attractive girl in from college, what could be more enjoyable than seeing a black-and-white film set in medieval Scandinavia dealing with the plague, death, and the emptiness of life? She was game, even eager to see it, and so we decided I'd screen it some afternoon when she'd be in town. Cut to some time later. I'm shooting Husbands and Wives, and on a Saturday when I'm off, Soon-Yi comes in from college, and I screen The Seventh Seal. Bergman's film ends, and we're alone in my screening room. And I'm giving my pedantic lecture on Kierkegaard and the Night of Reason. And she's listening dutifully, trying to keep her eyes open. And quite smoothly, if I do say so myself, I lean in and kiss her without knocking over anything. I brace myself for a bolo punch, the specialty of Kid Gavilan, the immortal ex-welterweight champion. But it doesn't come. Instead, she is complicit in the osculation, and to the point, as always, says, "I was wondering when you were going to make a move." Make a move? Give me a break. I'm still in some version of a relationship with your mother. True, for years we've just been going through the motions, but what are we getting into? But it was no use. We were attracted to one another in a way that would end up in a long and great marriage. And here are the awful details of what ensued. While I was filming the movie Husbands and Wives, Soon-Yi and I started an affair that began the next time she came in from college. Passionate from that day on, it has resulted now in many happy years and a wonderful family. Who would have predicted? I only knew She was not the non-entity her mother had dismissed and written off. How wrong Mia was. He was a sharp, classy, fabulous young woman, highly intelligent, full of latent potential, and ready to ripen superbly. If only someone would show her a little interest, a little support, and most important, some love. We spent a few afternoons walking and talking, delighting in each other's company, and of course, going to bed. We were sitting around my apartment one weekend afternoon, and I had been given a Polaroid camera for a present from someone who didn't know I had no interest in cameras. People always give me Polaroids, thinking they were so easy to work, even I could do it. I joked about me and any kind of gadget, and one thing led to another, with storm clouds gathering outside my penthouse window. At the very early stages of our new relationship, when lust reigned supreme and we couldn't keep our hands off each other, the idea arose that we do some erotic photographs if I could figure out how to work the goddamn camera. Turned out she could work it, and erotic photos they were, shots well calculated to boost one's blood up to 212 Fahrenheit. Anyhow, you probably read the rest in the tabloids. Mastermind that I was, I sequestered the photos in the drawer. But as it turned out, not all the provocative little snapshots. A number of them I had brilliantly put on my fireplace mantle as the Kodak squeezed them out. The mantle was eye level, maybe a soupçon higher. So when this epic photo shoot was over moments later, the ones on the mantle remained there, out of sight and out of mind, while the remainder was safely salted away. They say if Napoleon had been a few inches taller, the history of Europe would have been radically different. Well, if I had been an inch or two taller, just able to see over my fireplace mantle, carnage on a par with the Napoleonic Wars might not have occurred in Manhattan. Yes, a number were right up there for the casual browser to enjoy. But I lived alone. Still, I am not the kind of guy that can bring off an affair. Too much of a schlepper. Would Clark Gable or Cary Grant leave such incriminating photos right out on the mantle? Only a bumbler, all thumbs, a Jerry Lewis. True, I had a housekeeper who cleaned and dusted, and she might have discovered them while searching for fresh items to break. But I'm sure that being French, she would have shuffled through them with continental sophistication and merely given me a Madame Claude wink. The life-changing glitch came the following day when Satchel was brought over to my apartment, as he was each week, to have a private session with a child psychiatrist to address some personal issues. Sometimes Mia would bring him to these meetings. Invariably, he'd sit in the living room reading while he was taken by the shrink to another part of the fairly large penthouse to go over his problems. After an hour, he'd be marched back in to his mother. Anyhow, this Monday, the boy was a minute or two late ending his treatment, and his mother impatiently wandered into the other part of the house to see what was keeping him, and her eyes roamed over the fireplace mantel, where she discovered the group of Polaroids that would be heard round the world. Of course I understand her shock, her dismay, her rage, everything. It was the correct reaction. Sunyi and I thought we could have our little fling, keep it a secret, since Sunyi wasn't living at home and I lived alone like a bachelor. I thought it would have been a nice experience, and probably Sunyi would eventually meet some guy at college and enter a more conventional relationship. I didn't realize how attached to one another we'd already grown. It had started slowly, but once it hit, it was the real thing. Were it not for the discovery of the photos, who knows how long the burned-out, convenient regimen with me visiting the kids at Mia's apartment would have lasted. Of course, sooner or later, one of us would have been gone, as it was definitely over in spirit, if not routine. Sunyi said her mother had expressed wishes she could have moved on to some other man years ago. As stated, Mike Nichols was a frequent fantasy. Did I leave the photos exposed to bring the enervated relationship with Mia to a head on purpose? Was it my way of causing a breakup without really realizing it? It was not. It was simply a blunder by a klutz. Sometimes a cigar is just a blunder by a klutz. Psychiatrists say in times of crisis, one becomes who one is, only more so. The day Mia discovered the affair, she called all her kids together and spared them nothing. After explaining that I had raped Sunyi, which led Satchel, age 4, to tell people my father's fucking my sister, she called people and told them I'd raped her underage retarded daughter. She then locked Sunyi in her bedroom, hit her and kicked her, and she and Andre cut off her college tuition. She then phoned me in the middle of the night several times to tell me Sunyi was awash in guilt and thinking of committing suicide. She's a good actress, and when you're awakened at 3 a.m. and a hysterical woman is telling you someone is suicidal, it's unnerving. Sunyi was, of course, not allowed to use the phone, and this was pre-cell phone days. On the advice of a well-known psychiatrist neighbor, Mia was persuaded to send Sunyi to a reputable head doctor. Once out of the house, Sunyi called me and said, of course, she was not suicidal and didn't regret a second we'd spent together, but Mia had her locked up and was violent periodically. Sidebar, Mia hit her with a phone. When Sunyi described it in an interview she did years later with New York Magazine, the magazine asked her if there were witnesses. I thought, right, in the bedroom of Mia's apartment, there were pedestrians, construction workers, a bus tour of out-of-towners, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. There's always a big turnout in Sunyi's bedroom. The magazine, not looking for trouble, watered down Sunyi's account and wrote Mia slapped her, but she hit her with a phone. Sidebar to the sidebar. Daphne Merkin, who wrote the story on Sunyi for New York Magazine, relates how Ronan phoned the magazine prior to the story coming out and pressed them to drop it. They wouldn't, but he pressured them, and so they softened it in a number of places in ways that might not offend the Farrows. Example, Daphne and I saw each other for lunch, perhaps once a year, if that. But the magazine made up that we were close friends, so it appeared she could be prejudiced in my favor. And I already gave you the watering down and being hit with a telephone. They also had planned to put the story on the cover, but dropped it after the phone call from Ronan. Is this not the quintessence of hypocrisy when Ronan writes a book critical of NBC for trying to kill his story on Harvey Weinstein? But I guess whatever works. Okay, why didn't I say to Sunyi, bail and come to live with me? Because visitation and custody of my children was a real issue, and on a lawyer's advice, I had to be very careful till that issue was resolved. I was trying to balance Sunyi's problems with my own, with Dylan, Moses, and Satchel, whom Mia had possession of, complete control over, and a willingness to use them as pawns if and when necessary. I advised Sunyi to hang in, which translated means, I have no idea how to handle this yet, and can only say, when Mia tries to hit you, duck. All this was taking place over just a few short weeks after Sunyi had an introductory session with his very fine New York psychoanalyst. Mia was asked to meet with him. The doctor only needed one session with Mia to see what an unhinged and dangerous woman she was and instantly intervened to protect Sunyi. First, he asked me to put money in the bank to ensure Sunyi's college education. Of course, I did. She'd be able to return to Drew despite her mother's cutting off her tuition. The psychiatrist felt it was urgent Sunyi should get away from her mother. Fortuitously, Sunyi's brother had worked at a summer camp, and Mia began insisting Sunyi get a job there. It was in Maine, and Mia felt she would be safely away from me, whereas Sunyi's shrink thought she would be safely away from Mia. The fact was, however, Sunyi and I loved one another, and we spoke on the phone, and the camp told Mia. It wasn't long before Mia was raging more volcanically than ever, and Sunyi hated the camp and the freezing nights in Maine. She came back to New York, not daring to go home, and moved in with a friend whose mother had always been more of a caring person to Sunyi than her own apathetic mother. She put Sunyi up for a while, and it wasn't long before we were back together. We didn't want her to live with me because I was enmeshed in negotiations for visitation or custody of the kids. That would have been impossible to maneuver in court if we were living together. Mia knew we were in love, and while lawyers postured and threatened, I saw the kids in the most meager, distorted way. I did have a legal claim, but more potent than a legal claim, Mia had possession. fantasies of kidnapping them, gathering up Sunyi and sailing to the South Sea Islands to live on mangoes and coconuts crossed my mind, but just taking them to the papaya stand on 86th Street was more practical. It was around that time that Mia made that infamous, chilling call to my sister. She told her, "He took my daughter, now I'll take his." What she seemed to mean was that knowing how much I loved Dylan, she was embarking on a plan to see to it I would not be able to see her anymore. Dylan's feelings wouldn't matter. The loss of her father, whom she loved, wouldn't matter. She would be used to exact revenge. Mia's ugly plan would take some doing, but was it already forming in her mind? Another vituperative call, this time to me, ending with, "I have something planned for you." I joked that placing a bomb under the hood of my car was not a proportionate response. She said, "It's worse." She was so raging and incoherent on those vicious calls, which would come any hour of the day and night, that I'm surprised she was in control enough to plan a strategy more complex than ringing my bell and running. Attempts to de-escalate the situation did not work, and I guess it's easy for me to say as she was the hurt party, but where she took this rage crossed the line from understandable to unforgivable and then to unconscionable. Not only was it malignant to me, but horrendous for poor Dylan, who had just turned 7 and was too young to have any perspective. Nor was she caring of any effects on her prized son, Satchel, who was taught to hate his rapist father from the age of 4. Moses was already a teenager and not as easy to manipulate. Though past the vulnerable age of brainwashing, his loyalty at that point was ambivalently toward his mother. I vainly kept trying to employ reason. Our relationship had fizzled. We had not been intimate for years. Sunyi was not a child, but a college student. She was clearly not retarded, not underage. Yes, it was messy, but couldn't we try and solve this mess I admittedly caused by calming down and trying to explain things to the kids, who would certainly be better off if talked to properly and not inflamed or frightened? Isn't crying rape a little hysterical? Does it help to tell people she's underage when she's not? And why threaten to take my daughter? Should the kids be used to wreak vengeance? Do you really want to deprive Dylan of a father to punish me? Are there no limits to your vengeance? And what is this awful thing you have planned for me? Is there no way we can cool this down and do what's best for the kids? About my love of Sunyi, Moses said, "The kids recognized it as unorthodox, but the relationship itself was not nearly as devastating to our family as my mother's insistence on making this betrayal the center of all our lives from then on." I visited Mia's country house one early summer Saturday to see the kids for barbecue. This was a temporarily negotiated right. I, of course, didn't sleep in the same room as Mia, but on a different floor in a different section of the house, in a guest room. Whatever festivities or Frankfurters occurred, I roamed around trying to enjoy my few moments with Dylan, Moses, and, if possible, Satchel. I returned to my room to find a note Mia had pinned to my bedroom door. It read, "Child molester at the barbecue. Molested one daughter, now after another." I knew Mia was fond of telling people I had molested her underage daughter when, in fact, Sunyi was 22, and, of course, our love, which has resulted in a marriage of over 20 years, was hardly molestation. Remember, this ugly note she pinned to my door was prior to any suggestion of abuse. Was she laying the groundwork for what would be a frame-up? I assumed from the note she was mentally out of control, and it never occurred to me I was being set up for a false accusation. Who thinks that way? A few weeks after the loony note, still prior to any allegation, she phoned Susan Coates, Dylan's doctor, and said, "He must be stopped." Dr. Coates warned me about it and testified on my behalf in the hearing. In hindsight, which I'm good at, it's obvious a false accusation of molestation was to be a worse-than-killing-me plan.
Context of white supremacy.
So we didn't finish the entire section just because it's a little lengthy, but that's what we'll pick up at for next week, where we get more details. And in fact, I had been thinking, like, man, this seems like we did. I think the metaphor that Mo and Dallas used was Back to the Future. Like, we hopped into the DeLorean again. Like, we were kind of cruising along in the 1970s. The first sentence for next week is, so August 4, 1992, I float up to Connecticut. Like, we totally fast-forwarded through, like, a decade. Just in the material that we got, I was like, wow, we went totally from, like, Sun Yi is, like, 5 in flipping Korea. Now she's 22. Like, we almost went through 20 years, really. Like, whoa. Time travel. The number is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. We have about 30 minutes left in the broadcast. If you have any thoughts, observations, do not wait till the last minute. Go ahead and get a hand up if you have commentary to share. I guess now I'll really ask. I think I'd asked before, like, woof, we've heard quite a bit. We're over the halfway point, so we're closer to the end than the beginning. Like, why do people think Woody Allen wrote this book? One of our investors wrote in. He said, man, if Woody Allen wrote this book as some sort of, you know, hey, I got nothing to hide, and once, you know, I get to tell you my side of how all this went down, you will know that Woody is all right. He didn't molest anybody. He didn't do anything incorrect. He said if that was his intent, he has failed. What do folks think? And what do folks think about this naming, taking the names of black people to apply to these white children and or adopted children? Shout to the great Moses Malone. Let's see. I'll check, see if folks have thoughts. Get some of my news. Irie, not in Louisiana, although I did read today that 95% of New Orleans allegedly has power back. So, whatever that means. Irie, did you have commentary?
Yes. Hi. I haven't gone back yet. But really quickly, I think that he feels that he's at the end of his life. And he wants the last thing on record, hopefully, to be this book. I got curious and Googled Sun Yi, I think like 3 weeks ago he started the book. And she wrote an article in, I think it was 2017 or 18, saying that she wanted to clear her husband's name, air quotes, and that there were things that no one should know at all about him or should know happened at all. One of the things being the accusation of the supported accusation of him abusing Dylan. And I didn't get through it all. I did read a good bit of it about her, you know, basically talking about how, you know, they've had a wonderful marriage, all this other stuff. And it just was disgusting because I was looking at him all grayed and slumped over a little bit. And, you know, like, what is this man doing for you is what I was asking myself, like, other than keeping you as a pet and, you know, brainwashing. I don't know. Like, I feel for her, like, creator be with her. But she recently did that in the past, you know, 5 years or so. 3 years, and then he comes out with this book. He probably thinks he's about to kill over soon, and he wants this to be the first thing people come across, especially people who are readers, the people who are intellectuals, which he does identify as an intellectual. He wouldn't have wrote the book the way he did if he didn't identify himself as an intellectual, because he keeps appealing to white intellect. So those people that want to be refined and not go through the so-called grapevine, I don't know if that's, I'll take that back, because now I think about it, that may have something to do with racism. People that don't want to go through finding out through hearsay, scuttlebutt, they'll say, well, let me read on them. And then you'll be able to say in the book, this happened and I'm innocent. And if they have a affinity for his films, they're probably going to believe it. And you know what I'm saying? And it's the phenomenon with the O.J. Simpson thing. You know what I'm saying? There are going to be people that read the book because they want to be on his side. This book in particular, they want to be on his side and believe him. And this is a last-ditch effort for that. And it's pitiful. And the fast-forwarding, he's obviously ashamed. Like, either that, I would assume he's ashamed, or they told him speed it up, but he would have, you know, he should put some kind of highlight for a decade in there. But he knows what he did, so he doesn't want to put that in the book, because he's literally in the process of grooming a young girl to be a sex slave in that decade. And I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, Irie. Still not back in Louisiana, staying safe. She said those who want to miss the scuttlebutt, go right to the horse. Get that one in again. Go right to the horse. See what he says. They'll read the book and say, see there, I read apropos of nothing. Woody Allen didn't do nothing wrong. Y'all out here talking bad about Woody, trying to put some dirt on his name. That's a metaphor to support racism, white supremacy, too. Trying to come out here and talk bad about Woody Allen and Soon Yi. And then she has written a number of articles, Victims Guaranteed Qualified. I can quote Mr. Fuller here. Might do that before we wrap this one up. He has said, hey, tragic arrangements. You have a number of victims. Racial masochism, that's in the word guide. You have a number of victims where, hey, this white woman, this white man is the best thing ever. They're worth, you know, 50 of the black people, victims that I have known, and they marched with Dr. King, or they voted for President Obama, and they, you know all the history about Rosa Parks and Trayvon Martin. I mean, hey, this white person is awesome. No racist jokes, never called me a nigger, and all of those things may be true. This would still be a tragic arrangement. It would still be incorrect. It would still be an act of white supremacy racism, maximum racist aggression, for that white person to be in some sort of sexual arrangement, sexual activity with a non-white person. And this is just the added, like, and now that we've had, you know, we've heard Woody Allen talk about this and kind of skimp over the details a little bit, fast forwarding us through more than a decade, really about 15 years. There are folks who will cape for Woody Allen and say, hey, you all out there suggesting that Woody Allen married his daughter. Soon Yi's not his biological daughter. That's true. You all are out here saying that Woody Allen married Mia Farrow. They were never married. That's true. You all are out here saying that Woody Allen adopted Soon Yi. He did not. Only Mia Farrow and her previous white husband, Mr. Previn, they adopted Soon Yi. Woody never adopted her. That's true. All of that notwithstanding, that does not change anything about the incorrectness of this arrangement. Tragic arrangement. Like, not one thing. And I mean, we could just, like, hey, let's just make common sense. Anybody out there, male or female, if you had an adopted child, you had a partner, you all never married, but you all attempted care mates, so-called, can't say boyfriend, girlfriend anymore, ever. Woo! Attempted care mates. And so this lasts, you know, more than 5 years. You all are not married, but you're hanging out, doing stuff together, vacationing, all that. Children, see you around. Adopted children. at what point would this be, hey, I don't know if things are working out with, you know, the mom, the dad, but this adopted son, this adopted daughter who I met when they were 5 or 8, hey, now they're 19. Like, I think that's really where my, like, are you out of your flipping mind? Like, come on. That's, and I just want to make sure I include Woody Allen has a lot of this last portion of text that is dealing with accusations of child molestation. He has a lot of jokes. It has the same style that's supposed to be white wit and white intellectual humor that's in a lot of his films. I found that very disconcerting, certainly significant. If we were talking about R. Kelly and he was laughing and joking and putting in little funny quips along the way and saying, oh, no, I didn't do any of it. Like, are you serious? You're not even serious. I can answer the question. No, it doesn't even sound like you're serious about all this because you're making jokes and such along the way. Let's see. Let me look at some of the text. I'll keep an eye. Again, don't wait till the last minute if you have commentary, questions that you want to add. If we have anybody, even one person who is in the mind frame that, you know, I'm with Woody. I don't see nothing wrong with this. And, you know, if I had an adopted child or even if I had a biological child and, you know, this fella 35 years older than my offspring, and he's been around them since they were 5, 8, 10. I don't see nothing wrong with that at all. What is it? What did Aaliyah's age? Ain't nothing but a number. Or however else you rationalize it, feel free to share. We might have missed the boat on this one. Maybe we haven't read Mr. Allen's material accurately. Let me see. Portions from this segment. Oh, yep. Yes, sir. Go ahead.
I think in the case of Ophini, I think that's an example of a tragic travesty because it seems like she was used and parasitically drained by Mia Farrow in the adoption arrangement. She was used as an accessory and possibly as some sort of child servant for Mia Farrow. And then Woody Allen comes along, and then he drinks her, uses her sexually for what seems to be the remainder of her life until he dies. So it's just really incorrect how a racist man and a racist woman have, in their own ways of practicing racism, devastated this non-white female to the degree that she's writing articles defending her abuse. But that is exactly what the system does 24/7 to non-white people. And it's very, very incorrect. And hearing Woody Allen discuss Mia Farrow's parenting of Sunni and the rest of their offspring just seems torturous. White people do not care about children unless they are able to use the child for some sort of pleasure, some sort of attention from other white people. And just her making the, Mia Farrow making the child show its its braces so people would know that it's a disabled child is proof that she is using those children as accessories. So she wants to make sure the black one, a yellow one, and a handicapped one. And this is really sick. You know, the really sick behavior that no collective person on planet Earth should be okay with. And
that idiot, he says white people do not care about children. I don't even think he typically says non-white children. It's just children. Much obliged for the insight. And again, like I said, we had people who were like, I guess, following on social media, aware that we were reading this book. And it seemed like they were taking the position as though we were supporting Mia Farrow, like, oh my gosh, that awful no count Woody Allen, and oh, he mistreated her, and that Mia Farrow, she was a great mom, and she took it. That was not our position at all. That was never my position. We hadn't even got to Mia Farrow before this week, so we were, you know, that's why I said I think these people were just commenting on social media and not really listening, because there had been really no mention of Mia Farrow until this week. Now we got it. No caping for her. Abducting non-white children is awful. Period. Act of white supremacy racism. Let's see. Soon Yi being in this condition in the first place. Again, I've been hashtagging it every time. Anti-Asian violence. The masters are all classified as white. Now, Korea being in that state at that time. Matter of fact, Neely Fuller Jr., veteran of the so-called Korean War. Why is that area in that state of upheaval with non-white people? Oh, and then now you go to Korea. Wow, it is cracking. They say they have invested and put all this money. White supremacy rate. And you want to talk about white identification. Like, wow. But I mean, they can go and blow things up, tear things up, send Neely Fuller Jr.'s black people over here and go stomp this area up. And then turn around and go clean the whole place up and have it sparkling. Have the Olympics there and everything. Let's see. Next. Soon Yi. When he gives this account of how Mia picked Soon Yi out of the orphanage, I have no idea where he's getting that information from. I know that a lot of times people, when they're five, they don't necessarily remember, like, all of those events. So I'm just kidding. Like, is this something that he got directly from Soon Yi? She told him? Or did Mia Farrow tell him all of this and he knew? Like, I don't think he was there. So I'm just kidding. Like, if he says Soon Yi told him and she has a phenomenal memory and she can detail what happened when she was five and all this happened, like, okay, that's something I would think about. Like, wow. And I mean, they apparently, Mia Farrow did make some recordings of Soon Yi's experience when she was very young and still in Korea. So that may have been part of the recording. She may have recorded, like, you know, what was that experience like when Mia Farrow got you and you all did this? And okay. Like, maybe that happened. Let's see. Just so much of this. Woody Allen does so much of this. He was distracted. He's a klutz. He's stupid. Any white person, I've said for years, for more than a decade, white people are not ignorant about racism, that is one of the extraordinary components, acts of white supremacy. When white people come out talking about they're ignorant, that the problem is that they just don't know. I don't know anything about racism, and all of that is a lie. Even Woody Allen was at the March on Washington. He didn't say he was ignorant about racism. When any white person, when their justification is like an intense reliance on I'm stupid, I'm dumb, I'm not intelligent, I'm a klutz, I was distracted, that is so suspicious. White people generally brag about paying attention to all kinds of details and being way smarter than anybody who ever existed. That's normally the type of white people that I'm accustomed to. Like, it's rare. Like, what white person? Oh, no, I'm just dumb and ignorant and stupid and I don't know nothing and dumb and ignorant. No. Not in the system of racism, white supremacy, not anywhere in the world. Especially when it's, man, did you rape that child? Oh, what are you talking about? I'm dumb and ignorant and stupid and distracted. And what are you talking about? Let's see. Incidentally, all of this, that's a big theme in Manhattan and other of Woody Allen's work, sexual promiscuity. He in Manhattan is he's having sex with a 17-year-old. His friend is having an affair with a different woman, as opposed to telling that who's married, as opposed to, hey, why don't you do right by your wife, stick in your marriage. He ends up getting involved sexually with this white woman who's his mistress of his friend. And I mean, no boundaries, sex with every, his wife divorces him, and then she gets involved in a lesbian arrangement, and then she confesses that they had a threesome. I mean, it's just no boundaries, all kinds of sexual deviance, sex with children. They have little jokes in there that suggest bestiality. What does it mean to be white? What is white culture? That is rampant throughout Woody Allen's works. So for him to come back and Mia Allen was fooling around with these other people or wanted to, the neighbor and all that, I totally believe it. But he is greatly downplaying, like, what were you doing? You're not living there. And again, you're a white man. You're visiting the Playboy man. You're a white man who visits the Playboy mansion and doesn't do anything. Right, Woody Allen. Let's see. Oh, I read the Knicks article today. I felt so right on time, man. Walt Clyde Frazier mentioned in the text. And then the article that I read, Know Nothing Knicks fan, Woody, where it's again, Know Nothing. I'm just ignorant. I don't know. I've been watching these sweaty black males run up and down the court in Madison Square Garden for 40 years, front row. But I don't know nothing. I'm just dumb and ignorant. He says he had... I owned four season tickets to Madison Square Garden and sometimes had no one around who shared my interest. Interest in what? Is this like a Donald Sterling? Oh, my God. Thank you, Donald Sterling. Remember Donald Sterling? Before, years before he had to sell the team for $2 billion, the recording and the blackmails and all that, it was widely reported that he would go in the locker room. What did I just say? That O word, ogle black males in the shower, no less. Ooh, look at all those black bodies. Ooh. That might be the same type of thing that we have with Woody. In fact, I am submitting, based on what I've read here, that is what we have. Fetishizing homoerotic sexual attraction to these black males. Everybody he's named. He's even taking the names of the players, appropriating it for his own uses. In the film Manhattan, what the second thing he names, what's things that make life worth living? Willie Mays, Say Hey Kid. And then way later down on that list is, oh yeah, Tracy, the 17-year-old white girl. Unless somebody has a better explanation for why he's hanging out at the Garden for 4 years and then no black people appear in his movies. Except in Manhattan, there's a brief scene. He moves apartments and two of the movers are sweaty, large black males, but they don't have any speaking lines and they're not even in charge. They have a white boss who is substantially shorter and older than they. Let's see. Let's see. All of this, he has such a nice time with someone who's, and again, because we haven't gotten the exact dates and times, I'm submitting that he was probably doing these ball games and things when she's a teenager, 14, 15, something, somewhere in that age range. That is, you are approaching 50. How is it that you say the best time that you've had with another female is with someone who is a teenager, a child? You're approaching 50. There is something massively incorrect about that, even if it was a white child. But you are a white man with a non-white child? Nobody. You can write all day long. You can have all the white people who cape for you. Incidentally, I could not imagine these same white people having that sort of patience and lenience for Ara Kelly, Bill Cosby, Gus T, if I was accused. Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax in Virginia. Are you going to cape for him too? He hasn't even been accused, or he hasn't been criminally indicted, charged with anything. It's just scuttlebutt. Let's see. Oh my goodness. Now again, this is poorly edited. In my opinion, they could have at least, Woody Allen can say whatever he wants to, but at least we're going to edit this correctly. Like, Woody, you can't be saying that Mia Farrow's family was all criminal and gangster and your family was cool when you've already told us that your dad never saw a gun he didn't like and was firing it recklessly in public and all the rest and knew these gangbangers. You can't, I mean, come on. They're going to read the whole thing, Woody. This is another one now. You told us you and Louise at the restaurant went to get dinner. Let's go have sex in public. You did your whole shrinking violet act. Oh, what? No, we came to get dinner. What? But we did it. So if you've had sexual intercourse in public, literally, why would I think that you would hold Soon-Yi's hand in public at Madison Square Garden? Why would I think that would be out of range? Like, come on, Woody. That's what I mean. Like, you can't be that disconnected. If you can compartment, sounding like a lot of what they call compartmentalization, right? This is over here. It's not connected over here. We don't link all of this together. No. That sounds like someone who is maybe engaged in some criminal activity, some mischief. Let's see. Oh, and this, see, I told you, we hopped in the DeLorean, Mo and Dallas. See, he says, cut to sometime later. I'm shooting husbands and wives. It's like, wait a minute. What do you mean? Let me give the full context. So he says, and again, I don't even know when this is. He says, all I know is I took her to another basketball game, and despite the famous photo, again, he's ignorant. I don't even know what's happened. What? In a photo in which it looks like we're holding hands. I never took her hand. First, I didn't have that kind of relationship with her at that point. And if I had, I never in a million years would have done anything in public, much less in the brightly lit, packed area of Madison Square Garden. You've had sex in public? This is just holding hands. I don't believe you. My death wish did not extend that far. All this hyperbole? What are you even talking about? You didn't even get punished for this. You all sit at Madison Square Garden holding hands now, and there's no death threats. We chatted and had another very nice time. As we had gotten on the subject of movies, I asked her if she knew the movies of Inger Bergman, always searching for that perfect woman into Swedish films, the intellectualism. And that's the Nordic culture, too. She did not, and as I waxed euphoric over his work, it was decided I would set up a screening for The Seventh Seal for her at my screening room. This was me being romantic. The Seventh Seal. Now, is this hyperbole? Are you joking? Like, see, I'm such a klutz. This is not me trying to woo her. Or is this, yeah, this is me wooing her, but I'm such a klutz about going to do this. I'm taking her to basketball games and let's go watch The Seventh Seal and that sort of thing. I'm going to take the latter. Let's see. And he says, cut to sometime later. I don't know. Are we cutting to like years later? Are we cutting to next week? Like, I don't even know, because at some points he nails it down very specifically in terms of date and time. At other points, it's very vague, but we've just hopped forward in time. And some of those hop forwards are kind of disjointing. Let's see. Oh, and he says, oh, let me give it. So he says, cut to sometime later. This is important because it's cut to sometime later. I'm shooting husbands and wives. And on a Saturday when I'm off, Soon-Yi comes in from college and I screen The Seventh Seal. Bergman's film ends and we're alone in my screening room and I'm giving my pedantic lecture on Kierkegaard, the white intellect and knight of reason. And she's listening dutifully, trying to keep her eyes open. And quite smoothly, if I do say so myself, I lean in and kiss her without knocking over anything. I've never seen Woody Allen do anything smoothly. He does not have good hand-eye coordination. Instead, she is complicit in the oscillation to the point, as always, says, I was wondering when you were going to make a move. Now, this may have happened. System of white supremacy, racism, racial masochism. We have been trained, and she's adopted by a white person. So, I mean, talk about white identification. But again, I guess we could look at when Husbands and Wives was produced and kind of pinpoint it to some degree what time period this was. But you're always going to be 35 years older than her. At this point, Woody Allen would be at 50, in his 50s. And you're with a, now we'll say 20 or late teens, non-white female who you have been so-called dating her white adopted parent for a decade. Now I'm going to smoothly transition, and are still, you haven't even formally ended that, to transition to smoothly dating her daughter, who, again, the projection, hey, she, you know, was complicit, criminal, that's interesting language, complicit in escalating all of this. Yeah, it wasn't just me. She was equally, this was 50-50. She's consenting. She's an adult. It is always, I wouldn't care if he's 85 and she's 50, which happens to be the case now. I wouldn't care if he's 55 and she's 30. Regardless, it is always, always. Oh, and that's not even correct. It would be 30. He would be 55 and she would be 20. Make sure it's 35 years. It is always a man, woman, taking advantage of a child in the system of white supremacy. All of us, Gus T, non-white people, functionally, we are children. I think it's great, too, that this non-white person is non-black, so that all of the terrorism and pathologies of this system, yes, everybody has a lot of the same deficiencies, brain trashing. White identification, yes, all of the non-white people in the world. Let's see. Oh, man, we're almost at the end. Anything else? Oh, I got to get this one. And this is one that I heard this. They put this in the documentary. When I heard this, I was like, oh, yeah, we got to read that. He says, how wrong Mia was. Here was a sharp, classy, fabulous young woman, highly intelligent, full of latent potential, that sounds sexual, and ready to ripen, super sexual, superbly, if only someone would show her a little interest, a little support, and most important, some love. That right there just sounds like grooming. You can pretty it up and all that, just Well, we've talked about how in the system of white supremacy, predators, they have an excellent radar for the vulnerable. You tell me a five-year-old that's eating out of the trash can, trying to eat a bar of soap because she's so hungry, and gets abducted by this white woman. And hey, if you want to believe Mr. Allen, all the abuse that she suffered from Mia Farrow, which could totally be true, this would be a prime victim. Let's see. Oh my God, I didn't even got to do the pun. He says, at the very early stages of our new relationship, when lust reigns supreme. Pause right there. This is someone 35 years older. And lust, the incorrect, I don't care who you are, nothing about this is logical, correct. All of this is massive deviance, incorrectness. This is white culture, and call it lust. This right when Dr. Francis Cress Welsing talks about totally devaluing sex, this is it right here. And I can pretty it up, and we had that lust that reigned supreme, and we couldn't keep our hands off each other. The idea arose that we do some erotic photographs if I could figure out how to work the goddamn camera. I am not aware of erotic photographs of Woody Allen. I am aware of erotic photographs of Soon-Yi Previn. We didn't do erotic photographs. Soon-Yi Previn was photographed in erotic positions. That would be accurate. Woody Allen was not displaying erotic images of himself. It wasn't even the both of them. It was erotic images of Soon Yi, 35 years younger than him. Tragic. I mean, that's almost putting it mildly. Tragic arrangement. Now, would they cape for R. Kelly? They want to cape for Woody Allen. Are you serious? And show him at the Knicks game. Show him at the Knicks game. He mentioned Marv Albert. I even forgot that portion. I read that about the New York Knicks. Flipping Marv Albert, the reason he was no longer doing Knicks games because he got caught and criminally charged, found guilty for all kinds of sexual misconduct and sexual deviance. Man, birds of a feather, what they say. Jerry Epstein, Harvey Weinstein, what they say. He got a cape for his, oh my God, for totally forgot why I read that whole piece, man. And then Marv Albert got bought back. He just retired this year. I totally forgot that we are so in sync. Marv Albert came back, was doing national games. He wasn't just the voice of the Knicks. He got to do all kinds of basketball games. And I think I would put money down that I think this season the Knicks made the playoffs for the first time in like decades. I suspect they had Marv Albert at least one of those games. Nobody's going to bring up who you bit before and prostitute this. We love you, Marv Albert. They had all kinds of send-off. Oh, we're going to miss you, Marv Albert, the voice of a generation. And they didn't do the Kobe Bryant. And hey, me too, man. We got to. What does it mean to be white? They didn't cape like that for R. Kelly. Bill Cosby, they didn't let him come back on TV. Give us another round, an encore of The Cosby Show one time, Cos. So he takes all these pornographic pictures of Soon Yi, Wee, and it's the same thing. He's ignorant. I'm too dumb to even figure out the camera. I'm so ignorant. I can't even get the camera to work. I can't even get the remote control to work. Let's see. He's using this metaphor of the turmoil or conflict about these photographs and his sexual incorrect behavior, which there should have been, comparing that to the Napoleonic Wars. Are you serious? The vanity, the narcissism, the egoism, as though you, this one individual comparable to the entire Napoleonic Wars. Are you serious, Woody Allen? What does it mean to be white? Elevated sense of importance. Let's see. And he comes right back to the ignorance. He'll come right too much of a schlep with Clark Gable or Gary Grantley, such incriminating photos right out on the mantle. If you are a powerful white man, I can do whatever I want. So what? I got pictures of this non-white female, nude, doing whatever. So what? What is the problem? What are you all talking about? I've made movies about this that you all love. What are you talking about? You love Marv Albert. What are you talking about? Jerry Sandusky, Jerry Epstein. What are you talking about? Let's see. Anything else I have to get in since we did overtime? Make sure we can wrap things up. A blunder by a clown. All of that just further, in my view, indicts Woody Allen, where it's just got to be, oh man, I was just a klutz and a blundering idiot and I'm so stupid and I'm so unintelligent and oh, I'm just the lamest, goofiest, most ignorant schlemiel in the come on. Like, no, I'm just going to suspect you of being a rapist and a racist, sexual deviant, and your films indict everything. Just lines up your films, the writing, everything. He uses the word loony quite a bit as well to describe Mia Farrow and individuals who are suspicious, who think, hey, I do think Woody Allen has been engaging in some inappropriate sexual conduct. He will call them loonies. You'll hear that word again in the book. And I will stop there. Yes, I'll stop there for this week. All I can say, man, all of the reasons that I wanted to read this book, bam, on display this week and will be for the remainder of the book. We didn't even get to all of the good stuff yet. Sometimes you just have to be patient. Do we miss anybody? Anybody have a final thought before we conclude? grand, tragic arrangements. What is white culture? What does it mean to be white? Wow, you should have lots to think on just from this text alone and the sexual deviance rife within this system. We'll get back to this next week. Not lots more. We're close to the end, but we have a few more sessions to go. We'll be here tomorrow for Neutralizing Workplace Racism. Much obliged for folks tuning in. Hope it was worthy of your time and energy this Thursday evening. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy racism. We will need well-functioning brain computers to solve this problem. If you're going to go out and about, be alert. There's so much danger and violence, say especially in the U.S., but really worldwide. Be alert. If someone is being hostile and loud, exit. This is not a time that you want to be confronting verbally strangers in public. You should be thinking that this person, male or female, may be armed. In fact, they may have an entire armed entourage. If you did not leave your residence prepared to kill and or die, exit. That's what you should be thinking. Exit. If you're in a vehicle, in addition to being sober, you are buckled, trying to do the small things that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.